Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, whatever time of day it is for you. Welcome to the Silmarillion Film Project podcast. What number are we on, by the way?
This is session 24 of season 3. Right? Yeah, session
24. Okay, season 3. All right, cool. Now I'll introduce, or I don't have to introduce. Over to you, Corey.
Okay, all right, great. Thanks for that. We're gonna be. I'm looking forward to doing the casting as always. It's always fun, and as you say, Trish, educational. As I certainly don't follow things closely enough to know all of the people nominated and stuff. So it's always interesting to me to see that. So today we do have two special guests with us, whom I wanted to make sure to introduce to you. Bree Melvin and Anastasia Vogel, who have been huge contributors to our visual design elements, and those are the main things we're going to be looking at today. We're going to be looking at how we're going to be doing costuming, especially costuming. But it's really, I mean, it's all about the visual presentation, which is such a big deal. We talked about this a lot during the session in season 2 when we were trying to establish the, you know, those initial views of the different elf kindred and stuff. There are so many things you think about the role that these different groups have, the role that these different groups play in confusing people who read the Silmarillion, right? I mean, one of the things that is like a classic problem, a classic challenge of Silmarillion readers is how to keep everybody straight. Like, you know, which group is which again, and how are they connected with whom? It's really challenging. And so being able to use the visual element, of course, you get that's one of the big advantages, I think, of course, of the adaptation into the visual medium, are that extra set of cues that you're able to give, but not just to keep them straight. Like, right, it's not just like that we need to color code the elvish kindreds or something, but of course, what you can convey to people about them. And, you know, there's sometimes in our discussions when we think about, you know, we're trying to think through the culture, and we're trying to, you know, answer some questions about, you know, what would they do and what are their attitudes about this and that and all that kind of thing. A lot of that, I think, you know, you're really able to convey by visuals, right? By how you depict them, by how they dress, by their sets and all those kinds of things. So it's really fun to think through. It's really fun to think through how we would do that, right? And I think this is a really fun. So let me just start off by thanking you, Bree and Anastasia, for the work that you've done. I'll thank you again at the end, but I wanted to make sure to say that at the beginning, we really appreciate your contributions to this.
Welcome. Thanks.
Okay. All right. So, but I almost forgot before we get quick announcements, but only really quick. First, I do want to make sure to emphasize we have our summer camps coming up. I've talked about our summer camps before, but these are summer reading camps designed for kids ages like 10 to 14 or so. Our Hobbit camp starts soon. That starts not this coming week, but the week after. So what is that? The 9th of July. So we're coming right up on that one, but we have our Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone camp to follow that, our Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe camp to follow that, and our Wrinkle in Time camp to follow that. So we have lots of options this year. Strongly encourage you to check out signumuniversity.org/academy. This is entirely free, and we have not only daily class discussion sessions for kids to read along and come and ask questions and be part of that discussion. But we also have a whole huge fat, like 50-page packet that we will send you if you are a parent or facilitator, wants to get together a few kids to talk about this. We will provide you with a whole set of discussion questions chapter by chapter for the whole work, as well as like games and activities and stuff to do for kids of various ages and everything. It's really kind of awesome. So, and all this stuff provided to you absolutely free. We just encourage you to participate and help help the next generation of readers really to bury themselves in these wonderful works and really have an awesome imaginative experience this summer. That's the point of the summer camps, and we invite you to look into that, signumuniversity.org/academy. And then, of course, our next moot, we are having finished with Myth Moot, which was awesome. We are now shifting to looking towards the late summer and the fall moot season, as our regional moots are going to be kicking into high gear in this fall, starting with Bay Moot on August 18th and followed not too long after by Middle Moot in Kansas City, SoCal Moot in L.A., and Carolina Moot. I think they're thinking of changing the name to Magnolia Moot for the South, which is pretty awesome. That's going to be in Charlotte, North Carolina, on November 10th. So lots of fun regional events coming up. But in particular, Bay Moot, not only because it's coming up first, but also because the call for presentations was extended, and that extension expires tomorrow, I think. So now's the time to definitely get in on that. All right. Those are the announcements. Let's move forward. So we're going to start with costumes. As I said, both concepts and some art to visually suggest this. And in addition to Bree and Anastasia, who are here with us today, Harangil and Marielle on the discussion boards have contributed a lot. And we're going to be seeing some of their contributions here today as we go through. So, all right. Let's go. So the Teleri of Alqualondë are where we're starting. Okay. Which one of you wants to kind of walk us through your thinking about the Teleri?
That was me. This is Anastasia. Hi. Okay.
Excellent.
So my thinking on that was, so last season we had mentioned that the Teleri, and specifically Tolerisea, would have a lot of sheep on it, and so their clothing would be with a lot of felt, mm-hmm. And sort of needle felting, all that kind of textile art goodness. So I wanted to extend that further into this season, but also at this point they would have met the Noldor and the Vanyar.
Yes.
So, and I associate specifically the Vanyar with very, very fine weaving and needlework. So I wanted the Teleri to have learned from the Vanyar. And so what I was thinking in this season is that we could have them playing with the juxtaposition of this very heavy felted material with this very light sort of chiffon, gauzy kind of textures, so that they'd still have sort of their roots in Tolerisea, but then we could have cool shots of them walking along the beach with a really flowy garment blowing in the wind.
Right. Absolutely. That does seem necessary, right?
Yes. And so I found the image of Ophelia by John Everett Millais. And it's evoking what I'm thinking, but it's not exactly mm-hmm. what I'm thinking. So mm-hmm. if you look at her bodice, it's very encrusted with
right.
Embroidery and probably some beadwork and stuff on there, and you can tell it's like very heavy and structured, but then the fabric floating in the water is very light and has transparency to it, mostly because it's floating in water, but right. it sort of gives that juxtaposition that I'm thinking of.
Right.
And then Bree also mentioned about the stones that are on the beach and all the shells and things.
Yes.
Going from the beach to their clothes, which would be a fun thing.
Yeah.
So that's what I was thinking.
It's also mainly our main description of Alqualondë is that it is a beach, and that they covered it in jewels that they were given by the Noldor. So
yeah,
our clothing might reflect like the whole idea of those two things meeting, and also reflecting that image. And also the idea of having like a more solid top and with the more encrusted things with a flowy thing kind of creates the image of water flowing into a more rocky shore.
Mm-hmm.
So you get the mm-hmm. contrast. So it's right. naturally looking like a beach.
Right. Right. Yes, the beaches, especially for the Tulare of Alqualondë, you know, because of course they're very remarkable in that they're the ones that go to Valinor but stay furthest from Valmar, right? You know, if the Vanyar are the ones who come over most closely to dwelling among the Valar, it's not that the Tulare are avoiding the Valar, but we're told they rarely even go in, right? I mean, even when everyone else is at the festival, the Tulare are still out on the beach, right? So they're very much, you know, on the shores and associated with the shores. So it does make sense to be really focusing on that kind of beach element, trying to evoke that. Yeah. Cool. So one question that I have is I'm thinking about kind of evolutions and connections, right? Because, of course, the Tulare are, you know, as I was talking about the confusions people have with Kindred, and the Tulare are, like, obviously the biggest offenders in this regard, the Noldor and Vanyar. You know, with the Noldor, we got the different households and everything, and we do get some distinctions as we move forward, you know, whereas the Vanyar sort of remain monolithic throughout. But with the Tulare, of course, we get all the different subdivisions. And not only that, but them also changing over time. Do you see season three? So with season two, we had the, you know, the journey and then all of the divisions occurring and the time on Tulare and then finally the move to Alqualondë at the end and their friendship with the Noldor, and, you know, we got hints of a few things. We didn't spend much time on it in season two. We got hints of a few things like Eärwyn and Finarfin getting married and that kind of thing. But anyway, do you see introducing changes? Do you think that we should be thinking in terms of changes from the Tulare at the, you know, in season two to the Tulare in season three? Because this is kind of the sort of the final and steady state Tulare, right? In season three that we get.
Well, I kind of think of them. Go ahead, Bri.
You can go.
For
me, okay, who's going? You or me? I'm going to say you.
Yeah, I'm going to mute myself.
There's a slight delay in all podcasting that causes mass confusion.
Yes, exactly.
Okay. For me, in terms of all the elves, really, between their awakening to this state where they get to Valinor, that's like a big move and it's a big time of change and it's kind of a tentpole. And the main changes for all of them between that time period are mainly moving from a stationary but primitive culture to a migratory culture and then back to a stationary one but more technologically advanced. So it's I tend to think of it more as a technology change more than a culture change, but obviously the main culture element is whether or not is more based on utility, because you have these changes between staying in one spot, but they have limited resources and they haven't learned anything yet, to moving a lot and probably not being concerned with more decorative things, and then getting to a place where they have everything, they don't need anything anymore. They don't, so it's going to be more less utility and more decorative. So, so I wouldn't, besides that, I wouldn't think there would be any huge cultural changes between, say, like, what our season two or what our season three would be.
Right.
As compared to, like, once we start going to Beleriand.
Right. Exactly. Well, I was thinking about this when you guys were talking about, like, the gems, for instance, you know, moving from the beaches to their clothing and stuff. The gems are on the beaches, right? Because when the Noldor give them gems, at first they don't value them in the same way that the Noldor do, right? So that, you know, they don't, they tend to just kind of strew them around and enjoy the effect, right? They like the fact that the beaches are now glittering with gems. It's not that they don't appreciate them, but they're not in any way possessive, and they don't, one of the ways I've always taken that also is that they're a little bit less, focused on personal ornamentation. And I remember in season two, when we talked about the Noldor, we were emphasizing a desire for, you know, gorgeousness of decoration with the Noldor. How would you guys characterize the difference between the Teleri's approach to sort of self-decoration and the ornateness of their costume versus, I know we're going to talk about the Noldor later, but just kind of as we're focused on the Teleri, are there any kind of distinctions that you guys would introduce there?
For me, the Teleri, especially in Alqualondë, their clothing would be more an expression of fun and creativity than it would be about possessiveness or showing off skills. So the kind of distinction that I have between the Vanyar, the Noldor, and the Teleri of Alqualondë specifically is the Vanyar would be less about showing off, but more about the process of making. So they would care a lot about the very fine needlework, but from far away you wouldn't really notice it. It's when you come up close and you see, oh, they really love doing this fine work. They really love, because when I do needlework and knitting and that kind of thing, I find it very sort of meditative.
Right.
So I think the Vanyar would have that kind of relationship with it. And then the Noldor, it would all be about showing off their technical skill and like inventing new and fun ways to sew stuff.
Right. Right. It would be about technique rather than Yeah. That makes sense.
And then the Teleri, it would be just fun and expressive and creative. And so they might actually, because you mentioned the lack of possessiveness, they might just share their clothing with each other, be like, I like that garment that you're wearing. And then that other person gives that garment to them and then they switch. And, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's really fun. But I mean, you're right to emphasize, and this is something I think, you know, especially with the way that we focus on the Noldor and them being makers and, you know, all that stuff. It's easy to kind of, I think sort of shift over much in that direction, and for like all the elves are makers, right? I mean, that's an elvish thing. It's not just an Noldor thing. And I agree with you as well, like that sort of possessiveness, right? Especially in the second half of season two, as we're doing the Unrest of the Noldor, you know, we wanted to be moving in a more and more sort of showy direction, right? Ultimately with armor and helms and things like that, as we were discussing last time, like a year ago. But anyway, yeah. So having that difference, I love the concept that you guys are putting forward about the costume of the Teleri being more marked by fun, just sort of being more whimsical and fun. Tell me more about what that would look like. Like, how would we convey that kind of like playfulness in costume?
Going back 1 second, though, one other difference I was thinking of just now between, say, the Noldor, but more specifically, like, the Fëanorians and the Teleri, would be that the Teleri seem to be, like, we describe their clothing as basic being, taking design elements and being a visual representation of where they live, and I feel like their creative process differs in that they're sort of just making fan art of the Valar and appreciating what the Valar did, whereas the Noldor become increasingly more, their art's more about themselves.
Right.
And they drift away from, like, representations of the Valar, though we do see the, like, Turgon making the trees and stuff, but that's kind of about it. The gates he makes and all that are not really related to the Valar at all.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. So that the Noldor art would become less representational then, you were suggesting.
Yeah.
Okay. That's really interesting.
Just more self-centered versus
right.
Appreciating the others, and they go off by themselves too. Another mistake.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. That's cool. Go ahead.
And then what I was thinking about how to show the fun in the Teleri's garments is I always think of textile artists and kind of what they wear. And I don't know if a lot of you have met a lot of textile artists.
I don't think I have.
But what I notice about their clothing is that they do a lot of experimentation, and it's not always beautiful. Mm-hmm. but it's always interesting, and it's right. always, and it's always like trying new things. And well, I already said experimentation, so that's redundant. but it's like not always in line with what's in fashion or what's in style. It's kind of what they want to do. So that's kind of how I would express fun in that sense, so that not their clothing would not all be beautiful, but it would all be interesting.
Right. Right. Yeah, that is, and because, you know, one of the effects, right, that we would want to maintain is that while we obviously don't want the Tulare to be shabby or anything like that, yet nevertheless, we want to create the situation where when Feanor and his sons come into Aqualondë, they should be kind of looking down, like looking down on them, right? They should feel themselves to be above the Tulare, or, you know, to consider the Tulare like sort of rude or primitive and, you know, sort of uncultured in some sense, you know, kind of similar to the dynamic of, you know, an aristocrat looking at peasants, but an aristocrat looking at, you know, merchants and people who are not gentlefolk, but still, you know, neat and comfortably well off. They should be able to give themselves airs, right? And I think, you know, if the Tulare are dressing in a way which is like individualistic and even kind of weird, but lacking the kind of dignity that I would think the Noldor would kind of insist upon, given that sort of high focus on themselves, right, and that that increase in their own pride and their own focus on their own on themselves.
Another major visual difference at that point when they're meeting each other after, you know, they've already been in Valinor, would be that the Feanorians are going to be much more military looking.
Yes.
At that point, too.
Yes. Yes.
Versus civilian.
Yes. Yeah. And actually, it would be a really great way to emphasize the that particular dynamic, like the between the at the kinslaying, right? Is if the Tulare, if what the Tulare are wearing is not only not armor, but explicitly like wispy and gauzy and that kind of, you know, like to really emphasize the difference between, you know, we're dressing in these like foamy gauzy stuff for fun and you guys are wearing metal, right? And now you're attacking us with swords. It really does emphasize the inequality of that mm-hmm. situation.
Plus the shape language. I mean, the Feanorians are all pointy triangles. The yes. Tulare are all wispy. So.
Right. Wispy, billowy, difference. Flowing things. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Cool. I see. Marielle was asking, was making a Jane Austen parallel. No, the thing what I'm talking about would not be the Bingleys, like Miss Bingley to the Bennets, though that's close. I'm thinking more like with the Noldor and the Tulare, I would think it would be something that would be closer to like Lady Catherine de Bourgh to Mr. Collins, essentially. Mr. Collins is not a peasant, right? He's a gentleman, but way below, and looked down upon by the one who gives herself very great airs. Okay, cool. Yeah, neat. Karita says that she can imagine the Noldor doing, like, a lot of sketching and design and swatch work before they do, you know, before they wear anything, whereas the Tulare might, like, add to garments as they go and remake and edit and change things sort of spontaneously. I can definitely see that. Yeah, cool. Okay. Anything else you guys wanted to add about the Tulare?
Nope.
All right.
Next slide.
and we'll get back to talking. I think we'll do some contrast and stuff when we get to the Sindar and everything, because obviously we want some kinds of connections. But all right, so let's talk about the Feanorians, as we've already started talking about the Feanorians, so that seems fitting. All right, so you guys are thinking definitely more complex and more structured.
Yeah, yes. And I think that reflects their like love of gems too, to have.
Yes.
Clothing that has these angles, but then also like a bunch of them, because you can fold fabric in a certain way to do this. Anastasia knows more about it than me because sewing and me don't really work out so well. but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was, so these two images are from the 2014 adaptation of La Belle et la Bête. Mm-hmm. And the designer in that, if you look at La Belle's costumes, there's a lot of like folding work and smocking and very detailed structural elements of the fabric. So it's very much playing with the fabric, not so much embroidery and beadwork.
Right.
And that's kind of what I associate with the Noldor, is they would try very hard to invent new and novel construction techniques.
Yes.
They'd play a lot with structure. They'd play a lot with how to fold fabric to create interesting shapes. And they... What was the other one? And at, by this season, they would have very strong shoulders and collars, because that's kind of associated with not being so nice. And yeah, and the next slide with Bree's drawing actually has that silhouette that I'm thinking of,
right?
And Bree can sort of speak to that.
And the two dresses on the previous slide, they're more examples of like level of detail and technique,
right?
Obviously, color scheme and the actual period of these dresses don't match, because No, this is like, what, 17th, 18th century stuff?
Right.
I kind of get that stuff mixed up. But we're dealing with a much more medieval culture. So,
right.
But like taking elements from these later human trends and applying them as ways to make the elves look a little bit more technologically advanced, but still using a medieval aesthetic, also helps separate elves from the more, well, the designs for men, because both of them are going to be medieval, but there needs to be some difference between the two.
Yeah, and as you say, to have that be reflecting essentially technological advancement, just to have the clothing of the Noldor be, you know, made in ways and of materials that men just can't do and initially wouldn't even imagine. I really love this idea. I certainly wouldn't have thought of this, but that does strike me as very Noldoran. This, you know, if we're going to make fabric, right, we're not just going to make fabric and then decorate. We're not going to leave the fabric as a blank slate and then decorate it, right? That would be like the minimum that you do, right? But even better is, if you're going to be making fabric, why not make fabric in cool ways itself? Like, let's make an art of the fabric making and folding and of course of the design itself. So it's not just dresses with lots of jewels on them, right? So, and I have to admit also, this is kind of exciting for me because I've never even heard the word smock used as a verb. How does one smock? What does that even mean? I don't even understand that word.
Smocking.
Oh, we've learned a new word.
I've learned a new word. This is awesome.
Smocking is basically you... how to describe without actually showing you.
It's
similar to folding.
Okay.
And like pleating, but you don't iron it. So you take part, like you pick up little stitches in the fabric and then you pick up a little stitch somewhere else and you bring them together.
Okay.
And depending on the pattern you use to pick up the stitches, you get a different sort of pattern in the smocking.
Okay.
Right? So a lot of people are used to seeing the smocking that's on sort of child's clothing that's made with elastic thread in the back, and it's very linear.
Right.
But if you pick up threads in different, or if you make stitches in different patterns, you can make different patterns of smocking.
Oh. So is...
So
is,
if you like look very...
Pinching.
Okay, right.
Yeah. So if you look very closely at the white, or the off-white dress there.
Yes.
On the skirt, the top of the skirt area.
Yes.
That, I'm pretty sure it's smocking.
Okay.
I can't, like, the
so that is
quality
a dress that
on
has
the image
been
was
smocked.
Not great.
Does one use the past tense? Like, I smocked that?
Yes.
It begins to sound kind of vulgar when you say it like that. But yes. Okay. Right. Good.
Well, after you're done, you're kind of done with the dress. You're like, oh God, I worked on this so long. I hate it. My fingers hurt. So maybe it works.
Okay. Okay. Yep.
While we're on the topic of the difference between the men and the elves, mm-hmm. one thing that I had thought about just as a general sort of difference that would be continued throughout the series is the idea of mortality versus not mortality.
Yes.
So the elves having this idea that they live forever would make their clothes fit them really well and right. not be able to be altered very easily. Because right. they're not expecting to die. They're not expecting to have on their clothing.
Yeah, exactly. You don't get hand-me-downs right, in Elvish families.
Yeah, or change
right.
dramatically and change each decade.
Right, for instance. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. But the men, on the other hand, they would have these sort of garments that would be passed down through the ages that would be made in such a way that they could be altered very easily to suit many different body shapes. So that's kind of what I was thinking about the Noldor here as well, is they would be very interested in fit and in like particular shapes that would not be easy to be altered.
Right. Yeah, no, that's great. Now, though, it does raise a sort of question. Which do you think? And on the one hand, I can see this going either way, right? Either elves being immortal would be more likely to design clothes with the assumption that they're going to last a really long time, right? And perhaps part of their the virtue of elvish clothing, right? The way in which hobbits might call them magical garments, right? Would be that they might endure, they might last for a really long time, much more so than human made garments, for instance. But I can also kind of see it going the other way, whereas you say, like, you know, men don't have as much and they're going to be handing down their garments as long as they can, whereas the elves, like, since the design and the making is part of the pleasure, might not design their clothes to last forever because they want to keep making them, right? They want to make more. Which do you think which of those or both, which do you think would be dominant? Mm-hmm. I can kind of see it going in
the
way
they have more time to make them,
right? Exactly. Well, that's the thing. You know, like they have infinite time, right? So they could take, months and months and do nothing other than, like, make one, new suit of clothes, right? Because why not? Like, it's their creative expression, which is kind of their job, right? So,
yeah. I think it would depend on the culture as well. So the Vanyar, for example, would just have one garment and make it last. Mm-hmm. But I think the Noldor would be more inclined to have, like, wardrobes full of
right.
just clothes.
right.
And the Teleri, because they would be just having fun with it, some of their clothes would last a long time, some of them not so much, and that would be fine,
Right, right. Yeah, I think that's a really good... The Vanyar, I agree. The Vanyar would... because they wouldn't spend a lot of their time making clothes, right? Even if things like needlework and stuff were something that they did... Nevertheless, I don't see them. I would see them going more towards weaving, really, even like tapestry weaving and stuff like that, sooner than I could see them spending a lot of time in like the making of elaborate wardrobes for themselves, as I think you're rightly mm-hmm. suggesting that Noldor would do.
I'm not even sure that it would be like it would result in multiple outfits because. I mean, I'm not sure about this, but I mean, like, when I read more medieval stuff, they'll usually have some girl who's working on dress because they had nothing else to do because they weren't allowed to do anything else.
Right.
And it's like they're just taking an older dress and, like, working on it, mm-hmm. like, that they've had for a long time. So they usually have, like, the one good one. And it seems like they just keep adding to it over time. So
right.
maybe, like, they have,
yeah.
like, a more important one and it just becomes more elaborate over the centuries. So it doesn't look like patch jobs, but it kind of is. Like, it's staying repaired.
Right. It would be really
interesting.
But it's
also getting more decorative.
Yeah. It would be really interesting to have, like, a Noldor character who could appear in, like, three or four versions of the same dress over the course of multiple. Like, and we come back to her, several episodes later, and she has the same dress, but there's, like, something different. It's now, like, more elaborate than it was before. That would be kind of funny.
Yeah, the trick with that is, from a practical standpoint, a lot of the time when people would rework old dresses, they'd have to cut off a lot because the act of sewing a dress ruins the fabric, basically.
Okay.
So the seam itself would have holes in it, right? From the needle going through the fabric. So you couldn't use that piece, or you'd have to put some kind of beadwork on it, which I'm sure the Noldor would have time to figure that out. Be like, this part has weird holes and folds in it that I can't get out right now.
Right.
So I'm going to do other stuff with it. So, like, they'd have time to do that, but that's a consideration when you think about reworking garments in that way.
Right. Right. Yeah. Marielle was just asking a very interesting general question. Do we have any examples of elven craft that is temporary or transient? That's a really good question. I mean, I think that the first thing that immediately comes to mind would be music, essentially. I mean, there's a way in which you... I mean, of course, it's sort of obviously it depends, but I don't see... It's not like I expect... most of the music that's done by the elves to be, you know, like, and then that song was like memorized and played again and again. I would expect them to do a fair amount of improvisation, just like to play a beautiful song that is a beautiful song and is never played again, just like it was before. Right. So that's kind of a different situation.
You mean they hoard things.
Yeah, they do.
They're known hoarders.
They're known hoarders and preservers of things, right? So, certainly, if you have, when it comes
maybe
to
they
clothing,
make elaborate food, they eat it.
Right, food, there you go. Yeah, that
like
that
the
would
time
be
people post pictures of their food on Instagram, and there you go. That's
right. Right. Yeah. 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 No, you're right. Actually, cookery is like the classic example of transitory art, right? You can't like, or like ice sculpture or something. But yeah, no, that's true. That's true. Food would definitely be one example. But I guess thinking of the parallel that I was just making with musical composition, though, I guess that's the sort of parallel that I was suggesting as one possible way of understanding at least some elvish approaches to this kind of art, is thinking of it not as like, I'm going to create a work of art and then preserve it, like, you know, so that it will always be the same, like a painting on display or something like that, but rather, you know, I'm going to compose a work, and every time I play it, it's not going to be exactly the same, right? Because it's not just that one act of composition, you know, when I thought of this song, when I wrote this melody, that's not the creative act, right? The creative act is the continual performance of it, and every time it's different. Every time it's a creative act, right? Every time it's enacting this. You know, this artistic beauty, right? And to wondering if any of them, and if so, which of them might approach clothing this way, essentially, because clothing is more ephemeral than other forms of art.
What we were saying about the clothes, like editing it and it changing over time, so more evolution versus like temporary. Also, going to what you were saying about the music, we do have a more close-hand view of how the elves like create music, mainly because of Lord of the Rings and Fellowship of the Ring with the Hall of Fire.
Right.
Like, we do kind of get a glimpse of like, what they're doing.
Right.
Exactly. Remember the details, though.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Well, and it's hard because that's told from the point of view of Frodo, who's in his like half trance, half sleeping state, you know, at that point. So it's not extremely detailed, but yeah, exactly. Now, Nick was just saying, I don't know that we would classify composition as less artistic than performance, just different. Right. No, exactly. I mean, and that's exactly what I'm thinking there. Yeah. Yeah, cool. Well, I want to go back for a second. We were only very briefly on Brie on the slide with your design for the Feanorians here. Thinking about some of the stuff that we've been talking about here in general about the Noldor costuming. Do you want to sort of talk us through a little bit more about what you were sort of wanting to convey in some of the design choices here?
Like most of the art that I did that's going to show up in this PowerPoint, it's a few years old. Right. So, but I mainly, my general direction when I do anything with Sumerian stuff is I tend to focus on color. Mm-hmm. And shapes as they relate to the character, not necessarily individual character, maybe like the character of a group or a culture. So, I mean, Feanorians are always red.
Right.
This is the rule.
Right.
And I mean, it fits the personality. It fits the whole like fire motifs that we have. We actually know they had red plumes. We get red is associated with not necessarily bad people, but maybe in general aggression, and it's pretty ingrained to us as a species because it usually means danger. I mean, mm-hmm. blood is red, a lot of poisonous things are red, so it works. And then in terms of shapes, I tend to do triangles, but I don't do triangles because triangles are usually used for villains or mm-hmm. and whatnot because they're more threatening. And they have limited sides compared to like a square has more sides.
Right.
So you get more three-dimensionality versus more an archetypal villain, which is a little less three-dimensional. So I don't do it nearly as much as like Sauron, who is way more triangles than a Feanorian.
Right.
So I kind of balance it off by giving them more flowy things because I think of them as very, they're supposed to be like the royal princes, but they kind of gave that up, but right. that element of them is still there.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this, it's more showy. I think of them as more showy, mm-hmm. less, I mean, they fight a lot, but I feel like they do it in style.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I definitely agree. I mean, I think they would be the kind of people who would show up on the battlefield looking lovely, you know. Absolutely. I think that's really important. Yeah. And as Tony points out,
in terms of their armor also, before right. I forget, I also was kind of, I don't really think about the materials as much until after I've drawn it and go, well, what material could this be? But
right.
I was making their armor a bit more coppery color because we have that element where their grandfather really liked making copper things. So I kind of brought that element in. So
sure.
It's not completely coming from Feanor's side of the family. They do have a mom.
Right. Right. And it's good to, I mean, I also, I kind of like that even, again, just kind of fitting with the, like if they're armor were like, you know, silvery sort of burnished steel, it would I really like how the coppery color fits in with the whole like reddish theme. That seems to me to fit. I like that. And a nod to their maternal grandfather is a good thing, you know. I definitely like that. Yeah, cool. So you see them wearing a lot of like sort of robes, like floor length or longer robes, as on the right when not in battle, obviously. But
I think mainly of Maedhros, like that when he's at his war councils. I always picture him in this elaborate robe. It's just there.
Okay.
It's just permanent in my brain.
Okay, cool.
I'd also like to bring attention to the shape that Bree has made there.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the shoulders and the neckline are very structural, very
yes.
big, and then it goes down into, like, a smaller waist and then straight down to the floor.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the silhouette that I was imagining for them. So
yes.
it might not always be floor length, but if you squint your eyes and just look at the shape, that's kind of what it would be.
Right, right.
What I was imagining.
Yeah. Cool. No, I agree. And I really like the effect, you know, Bree, both with what you were talking about triangles, and Anastasia, your point about more elaborate structuring of garments and stuff. So yeah, both those shoulders and the stiff collar make a lot of sense to me in that regard. And you even have that in what a sort of more casual looking sort of tunic effect over here, like the one who's got his back to us over there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And I don't really have the detail on this, but probably if I drew this today, I'd probably add a lot more embroidery detail, stuff like that.
Right.
Just pattern, like older style of screen printing, with a lot of elaborate detailed designs that you see in like Mongolian cultures. I looked at a lot of Mongolian like detailed stuff when I was designing them.
Yeah. Question on Twitch a couple minutes back. Would you see Noldor's clothing being like jewel toned, or we were talking about red with the Fëanorians, but and I do think, I mean, I was joking earlier about color coding the elf families, but actually a certain element of that is a little bit handy.
I am completely in favor of color coding them because I do nothing else with my spare time.
Right.
I am also completely in favor of dual tones for the Noldor.
Dual tones, yeah. Yeah, you like that?
Or even if it's not dual tones, like strong colors.
Right.
Right, so
yeah,
not...
I give them strong colors, and I usually associate them each with a metal because I'm not going to make them wear like a helm of jewel because that doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Like you don't, it's not protective. So I usually try to evoke the idea of precious metals by having the more armor stuff next to the color.
Okay, right.
Another association I sort of have that's a difference between those who went to Valinor and those who did not is. There's a pretty distinct line in dress history between when there were only natural dyes and when there were synthetic dyes. Mm-hmm. So synthetic dyes tend to be more brightly colored and tend to be more color fast.
Right.
Whereas natural dyes tend to be more cut, so they have little, sort of more browns in them and tend to be less color fast. So that's kind of what I was thinking for Valinor, is that they would have the color quality of a synthetic dye, except it wouldn't be synthetic because that's not the world we're in. But it would have that strength of color and that brightness. Whereas when you go to Middle-earth, not Middle-earth.
Well,
when you go to Beleriand,
technically, yeah.
you would find more colors with like more brown, like more browns in them, so not as bright.
Right. Right. Yeah. So they're using. So,
I think I was subconsciously doing that. Mm-hmm. I didn't do it for that reason, but I was mainly doing it because, like the elves in Beleriand, they stayed in Arda. It is Arda, but they separated them. The others separated themselves and went to this place where they weren't really ever supposed to be. So they kind of lose their connection with the land. So then you have these elves who have colors that match the land more, whereas then you have these guys who are just colors that match their personalities more. So. Right. There's a visual disconnect between them and the land that they're in.
Right. Right. Yeah. Great. Now, Tim Fisher has a great question. What about, would anyone wear silks? Would silk happen?
Oh, we had a lovely discussion about that last year.
Okay.
So silk, the problem with silk is that you have to kill the silkworm to get it. So what happens is the silk moth creates the cocoon, right? Okay. The silk moth lays the egg. The egg becomes a worm. The worm then makes a cocoon.
Okay.
And in nature, the worm burns out of the cocoon, right? Which breaks the fibers.
Right.
So if you get a silk that is made with, or humanely, where no worms are killed as a result of the making of this fabric, then it's rougher because you have to spin it more.
Right.
Whereas if you boil the cocoons before the worm comes out, you can take the entire single length of the silk fiber and make that into cloth. So it's very fine.
Mm-hmm.
So we had an idea that maybe there would be a creature in this world that would produce fiber similar to silk, but that would not need to be killed in order to make that silk fiber.
I feel you're trying to say that the Feanorians wouldn't be okay with killing a bunch of worms when you know they totally would be.
Well, we were talking about it in the context of the Great Journey, so it wasn't quite
right
to the Feanorians yet.
Right, exactly.
But that was kind of the conversation that happened.
It would be
the most likely to wear silk is them.
Right. No, I totally agree with that. But it would be really a really interesting. I mean, talk about subtle, right? But it would be a subtle sign of their moral decline, right? when they began wearing silks, Yeah, that would be interesting. Nick suggests perhaps that the elves, being elves, could coax the worms out without damaging the fibers.
What they sing to them?
Right, exactly. So, like, it's sort of like the the silkworm version of elves riding without bit or saddle, right? they have a way with the silkworms, right? They sing to them. Yes, exactly. Now Marielle is suggesting by contrast that perhaps the making of silk could actually be a dwarf secret. So that would certainly recreate something closer to the European medieval situation, right, where silks come from the East and we don't know really how they're made or it's just kind of a mystery, right? So there could be like the horrifying moment when the elves learn how many worms are killed in the making of these garments, because the dwarves wouldn't tell them. I mean, I have to admit that the concept of like dwarves working in silks seems to me really odd. Like, I have a really hard time trying to wrap my brain around that. I mean, I guess I don't know that I could make an absolute argument for why they shouldn't do that. But certainly the idea of external culture and secrecy does seem to fit them. But yeah, go ahead.
There's an interesting point about silk that might change your mind. And that is that people used to use it as armor, loosely termed armor, against arrows. Because what would happen is that the arrow would go into the person and spin around, and the silk would spin around it, and then you could pull the arrow out.
It prevents the barbs from sticking. And I heard about this. That was a Mongolian technique, wasn't it? I seem to remember hearing about that associated with the
Mongolians again.
There you go. Exactly. Okay, right. So,
But I think there was discussion about the dwarves not having arrows until they meet the elves.
Right.
I think I remember that discussion.
Right.
Could go either way.
Right. Though it could be an application of silk, which dwarves developed post meeting the green elves when defending themselves against arrows.
I just don't know if they would pay enough attention to worms on a tree to find out.
Exactly right, yeah.
I mean, they wouldn't be. Maybe if they were living in rocks, they would have paid attention to them, but.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if we were imagining that the silkworm were subterranean, it would make it easier. Right. It would make it easier both to explain why the elves who were just mostly traveling across the land and then leaving, right, didn't know about them.
Well, it's a lot easier to picture the elves stopping every time there's a field of flowers to look at each new flower that they see that they have never seen before versus the dwarves who aren't. Like, you see Gimli going into Fangorn, and he's kind of being obtuse, and he has, like, the axe. He's not really thinking about the trees in the same way as a human or an elf would. So it's not so much proximity to the trees, it's more just, like, their relationship to them.
Right, right, right. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I don't know that I'm 100% sold on the dwarf thing. I could more easily see the dwarves being the one to adapt it for anti-arrow purposes once they learned of it. And of course, if we were careful, I'm thinking about the issues that the script folks were having with needing something besides pearls to give, you know, for the Sindar to give to the dwarves, you know, mm-hmm. in the what do the dwarves get out of this partnership question, you know, we'd had the problem of saying, well, they get pearls and they really like pearls, and in addition they can also get more pearls, right? That seeming kind of redundant in the end. So something like silk would be, you know, dwarves might be really interested in that for to use as materials in some way. So,
yeah, because silk is, as you probably know, a very useful, strong fabric. Right.
Exactly.
Right, because the reason nylon exists is because they were trying to find a different way to make a silk-like fabric for parachutes.
Right,
during the war.
Right.
So it could be a very good gift fabric in that sense.
Right. And thinking of nylon, actually, someone else was suggesting a little while ago, I forget who it was suggesting that, Tony was suggesting this. Would the elves make any synthetic fabrics? I mean, the Noldor might do that. I mean, obviously the proviso would have to be, I mean, of course, you know what Tolkien's, it seems like almost the only time, I can only think of two occasions on which Tolkien himself actually spoke about clothing. Right, it's not a topic of conversation that he got on very much in his writings, but almost the only things I can remember him saying, I'm not talking about descriptions, of which there's little enough when it comes to descriptions of clothing, but when he, like in his letters and stuff, when he's talking about clothing, it's either to talk about how he likes fancy colored waistcoats, or to complain about modern clothing, right? About zip fasteners and things like that. So obviously, you know, shift towards things like, you know, elastics and nylon and zippers and things like that he hated. And that it, for Tolkien, was a big part of his kind of complaint about how as modern technology was increasing, everything was getting shabbier. Right, that like modern clothing look more drab and
I mean, he wasn't wrong.
I know, exactly, right? And it's the same.
I mean, they specifically design clothing for females to last less time than clothing for men, because there's this whole thing about like women buying stuff usually, especially like 1950s housewives thing.
Right.
So
right.
It's like we're forced to keep buying more things because they fall apart, right. And then you get that whole thing from Hitchhiker's Guide with us turning into birds because of it.
Right. It's the same complaint he had about architecture, right? With like ugly modern concrete buildings and stuff like that. And one of the, you know, in the places where he talked about this whole trend in more detail, he talked about, you know, like the pride of a craftsman in his work compared to just, you know, modern factories just kind of churning stuff out. So obviously all of that stuff, I bring up all that stuff as a kind of, you know, asterisk proviso on the issue of synthetic fabrics. I'm not suggesting, obviously, I think it would be very bad for us to move in a direction that would even look like that kind of thing. And yet, I mean, Tony's right that some kind of synthetic fabric would certainly be possible. I mean, we could have something which was represented, you know, which was portrayed on screen by silk, right? Even if it is not silk that is actually derived in the same way from the silkworm as real modern silks are.
I mean, I don't know the history of synthetic fabrics. I don't really get how they are in existence at all. I don't know about that stuff, but Anastasia might. But so I don't know at like what point we started doing stuff like that, mm-hmm. and I don't know how much of that technology would make sense in a medieval world. So I have literally no clue.
Right.
Well, synthetic fabrics. It's a tricky question because, polyester that everyone knows and loves, it's a petroleum byproduct, basically. Mm-hmm. But things like rayon, and I think I always mix up this word, I think it's viscose, are made out of cellulose, but they like mush them up and mix them with different chemicals in order to make a fiber out of them. So it kind of depends on what you're talking about in term when you're talking about synthetic fibers.
Right, right.
As to whether it applies. So I can imagine, and it also depends kind of on how you perceive the Noldor interacting with chemistry.
Right, right.
So I can imagine them inventing a way to make a fiber that was different, but I think we would have to really divorce ourselves from our modern idea of synthetic fibers to imagine that.
Yeah,
in terms of sciences, I think the elves are more of a natural scientist, geology sort of thing, maybe.
Right.
Biology, whereas the only people I can think who would be really into chemistry would be the dwarves as early as possible, anyways.
Right, exactly. Well, I just thought of another suggestion, actually. You know who seems to me to be the most likely group of people to make synthetic fabrics? The Numenoreans. The Numenoreans would be into chemistry. I think. Especially later.
Yeah, exactly.
Especially later in the Second Age, as the Numenoreans start to decline. I mean, this is something that gets toned down.
The dark Numenoreans.
Yeah, the darker Numenoreans. Right. You can tell that they're evil because they do. They're chemists. Right. I'm just kidding. Mostly, but. No, but seriously, in Tolkien's early writings, of course, you know, in the Lost Road materials and the early Fallen Numenor stuff, it's very clear that the Numenoreans, by the end of the Second Age, the original part of the myth is that the Numenoreans had progressed to essentially modern technology. They had flying machines and cannon and ironside ships and everything else in their final attack on Valinor. And the reason Sauron's army wouldn't face Ar-Pharazôn when he lands in Middle-earth is that Ar-Pharazôn had artillery and Sauron's people didn't. So they ran on the first bombardment. Now, again, that gets toned down in, you know, the Akalabaeth and the Silmarillion. We don't see that anymore. And Tolkien was clearly backing away from that idea as time went on. And I'm not suggesting that we, you know, actually follow that original plan and have... the Numenoreans attacking Valinor in Blackhawks or anything, but I do think that technological advancement, accelerated technological advancement, I think could be something that really could be a marker of late Numenor. And that's where we might want to introduce things like synthetic fabrics. And even the Numenors get evil enough that maybe they actually do use zip fasteners, you know, like that could be, you know, they might even decline to that point by the end.
And the technology of zippers was lost to the sea.
Yes, exactly.
They're going to come back again for few more thousand years.
Exactly. Exactly.
Why everybody got a hate on zippers?
I know. but anyway. Okay, so I agree. I mean, it would be kind of interesting. I mean, Tony was suggesting, on the subject of the question of, like, having the sort of the Feanorians make a kind of pseudo-silk. Tony was saying it could be like the cloth equivalent of the mysterious material that the Silmarils were made of, right? We don't have to explain it. Just say that, like... You know, the Noldor have developed this technique and nobody else knows how to do it. And so they're the only ones who have it. And, you know, that could work. We don't have to explain it. Like, we're not going to be doing a sort of documentary of the, textile manufacturing techniques of the Feanorians, right? They could have... You know, some kind of technique that they
this stuff
have
never
found.
Shows up as like exposition or anything.
Right,
this just shows up in the behind the scenes DVDs. That's where that's about it. It's just you got to actually physically make the costumes. So.
Right, yeah. right, exactly. Yeah, cool.
Shall we move to the next slide?
Let us do that. Okay. All right. The Host of Fingolfin. So here we have... so I'm guessing, thinking back to what you were saying about metals here, we have mostly coppery metals with the Feanorians. With the Host of Fingolfin, you have more gray. So that would be more of the shiny steel?
Yeah. Usually when I draw stuff for First Age, I tend to draw it around the period where the men's stories start, because right. those are like the three big stories of the Silmarillion. And that we spend the most close time with, like it's not a wide view.
Right.
These would be less Fingolfin and more Fingon. So after we're already in Beleriand for a while, so it's when they're crossing the Hill Caraxi, I wouldn't think of it being so militaristic yet, because they're not guarding the northern borders of Beleriand from Angband. So, and I think that their fortress up there, since it's in a mountain, they probably had some access to some
metals.
What's the word for metal?
Yeah, ore.
So, but color scheme, like I usually Fingolfin, you think blue, and it's not even. I don't know why, but we all think it probably because it's the opposite of red in terms of character colors, but you just like if you look up fan art online, Fingolfin is always blue, and it's probably also related to like the Helcaraxi, and then you get ice colors and stuff like that.
I really like
it's also
blue
in the north,
the
so fur.
I know exactly. I really like blue as the dominant color of the Host of Fingolfin. Actually, the question of the crossing of the Helcaraxa brings up one of the big questions that I had. So the Noldor crossing the Helcaraxa, how inappropriately dressed are we going to have them be, right? They're not going to be all bundled up. I mean, they can't be, right? They didn't come prepared for an Arctic trek when they left Valinor. When I say inappropriate, I not only mean, not wrapped up head to toe in furs as you might expect for an Arctic trek, but even like how many of them are wearing like gowns and stuff like this as they're crossing the Helcaraxa, because they would have left in that, right? I mean, this would have been their everyday wear. You know, they're like the fancy smocked things that we were talking about before. And I totally am going to go out of my way to use the word smock as a verb as often as I can in the next few days. So anyway, so how many of them are going to, so that's what I mean when I say like inappropriately dressed. They might look, I mean, we don't want it to be absurd, obviously. We don't want to inspire laughter at the elves that are crossing the Helcaraxa. But again, I'm just thinking of, because of course the crossing of the Helcaraxa is the primary storyline of the Host of Fingolfin during season 3. Mm-hmm. So, in particular, that's what I don't see a huge distinction, Brie, as you suggested, dominant colors and things like that. And there would be some differences even at, say, the kinslaying, right? When we get the people of Fingolfin coming in and engaging in their part of the kinslaying, and they're armed as well, right? Unlike the Teleri. So there would still be a contrast, perhaps less of a contrast between the people of Fingolfin and the Teleri as there is between the people of Feanor and the Teleri.
Yeah, I think color wise, but like if you think of the Fingolfin contingent of the Noldor, I think maybe they might have some yellow accents while they're in Valinor, because I think of like the Vanyar,
right.
And so maybe like, and also I'm on a podcast, so I can't remember everyone's names all of a sudden, even though I normally know all the names.
This happens all the time. I know
the third
right?
brother,
yeah, Finarfin, yeah,
Finarfin, right, Finarfin, I tend to think of him as having yellows as well. I mean, he's the blonde child. So, right. And he kind of separates from them. So that yes. color would go away.
Yeah.
And after they cross the ice, it'd be complete. Maybe it'd be replaced with white. I'm
right.
thinking of this just now.
My sort of idea, I don't remember there being any indication in the book as to whether after the kinslaying and all that, they had time to prepare for any kind of journey.
Well,
do you
So
it
yes.
sounds like they just grabbed all their swords and ran, like both groups. The only prep I could think of is that Valinor got dark, so maybe it got cold, but not Helcarax are cold.
Right, not Helcarax are cold. I mean, plenty of time passes. I mean, they travel up the shore from a substantial amount of time elapses between the kinslaying and the crossing of the Helcaraxa. Indeed, we even are going to have an episode with them camping, like after the Feanorians leave in the ships and before they go on the Helcaraxa. So we're even suggesting the passage of a certain, much less time, but still a certain amount of time between when the Feanorians leave and when they start crossing the Helcaraxa. So there's time for them to do some preparing, but they don't really know what they're preparing for. And, anyway, are we going to have them? So we should talk about furs.
For me, right? It depends on whether.
So, but go ahead. It depends on whether.
So basically, if they leave for the journey immediately and have mm-hmm. no time to prepare, they will be wearing whatever they were wearing at the kinsling.
Right.
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 If we assume they had a couple of days to prepare for a journey, they will be wearing traveling clothes. Now, as to their preparedness for the Helcaraxa, how do you pronounce that?
Helcaraxa, that's just right. Yeah.
Okay, great. it doesn't get cold immediately. So they will be encountering colder and colder weather, and they mm-hmm. will be encountering animals with furs that they can use to keep themselves warm, which is something that I wanted to use as a sort of a distinguishing feature of the whole host of Fingolfin after the crossing.
Yes.
So they will be becoming more and more prepared, but once they get to like the icy part where basically nothing lives, that will be where a lot of death happens and a lot of not preparedness happens.
Right.
And then after they've crossed the Helcaraxa, they will have all of this cold weather wear. And then one of the notes in this slide is that from there on, furs will be an important part of their ceremonial and court dress.
Yes.
As a way of remembrance and as a way of saying, hey, Feanor people, you made us all die and we're not going to let you forget it.
Yeah. Memorial in a couple different ways, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not only for their own sake, but for the sake of Feanorians. Yeah.
But also, hey, we live in northern snowy mountains, and we sort of learned from our mistake.
Right, there's that, too.
Also that.
Yeah, Hithlum is not...
Yeah,
is
also
not,
the fur helps... The fur also helps them look more like good guys, relatively speaking, between all the groups, because it usually will make a round shape and circles, so are friendly. So,
right, yeah. Right. Yeah, no, I really like that idea of Furby. And that can be a real distinction. Like, the Feanorians can never wear fur. Like, we should have them, you know, that can be a really absent. Not that everyone in the host of, Fingolfin must always have fur on at all times, but to make sure that the Feanorians never have anything in fur makes a lot of sense. And I think that just only those who cross the Helcaraxa wear fur is cool. Yeah, I like that. I like that a lot. I mean, of course, it's one of the challenges that we talked about, you know, way back in doing the episode. It's one of the challenges of depicting the Helcaraxa crossing, because, of course, one of the factors here is that these aren't humans. These are elves, and their relationship with the elements is different than ours. Nick, of course, is reminding us about the crossing of Carathros and how comparatively little Legolas was affected by that, right? So,
in the movie, that shot of him walking on the snow, I'm all happy.
Right.
Exactly. I remember that shot really well as a kid because I was like, he looks like Link from The Legend of Zelda, and that's pretty much was how I got into Lord of the Rings.
He did look like Link from The Legend of Zelda.
I was like 11, so I mean, it was influential.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So yeah, no, it's
I think there's a difference between Caradhras and the Helcaraxa though. Like, we're talking about Arctic in the Helcaraxa.
We're talking about Arctic and we're talking about like weeks and weeks of travel. So
water.
And right, exactly, and icy water and everything else. So yeah, no, it's clearly, but yeah, right, the challenge is how to visually, when you don't have any point of comparison, right? Like, we can't have any, you know, useful control groups of human beings freezing to death while the elves go on, right? So we can't, it's hard to convey. They are enduring way more than any human could even begin to endure, and it's so bad that even they are suffering is challenging.
I don't think it's that hard, because you always get people watch movies, me, where you're like, they should all be dead. They should all be dead, right? Like, every action movie. They should all be dead, right? And really, anyone crossing the Arctic without any jacket, even if they have a jacket, you're like, you're all dead.
Right.
So it's like, they're elves. Okay. Well, I guess they're not dead because they're elves. Right. And they look cold, so it sucks. And that's really all we need to know. It's miserable. We don't need to know, like, oh, how is their sucking compared to the sucking of another race? Like,
right,
we
exactly.
just need to know how they feel in the moment. It's their story.
Right. Right. Yeah, no, that's true. And it would be really interesting to, one of the things that I would think I would, so they would have some furs, but I would still think that they would be underprepared. Like, it's not like every single one of them would be all bundled up in fur. Like, they don't have enough time to, get that many furs, right? So they would have some fur, but I would imagine thinking again, what we were, the costuming stuff we were talking about the Noldor in general, and especially as many of them are dying, right, during the crossing of the Helcaraxa, in the latter stages of the Helcaraxa, I can imagine many of them would be basically wrapped up in we would see many of the clothes that we might have seen earlier, you know, being worn gorgeously by people, just kind of crudely wrapped around as extra layers, right? You know, somebody like
Absolutely.
Wrapped up in somebody else's dress, basically, just to as a desperate extra outer layer of and to see it being, you know, being torn and frozen and everything. So it would be a really interesting way of kind of conveying the extremity that they're coming to.
Yep. I was just thinking, like, Anastasia, yesterday you were telling me that you thought about the Teleri having, like, sheep and stuff from Tol Eressëra and stuff.
Right.
Right? That's what you told me. Well, maybe when they steal the ships, they steal some wool.
That's
right. We're making off with your ships. And we're taking the sheep, too. And you can't stop us. Yeah, well, I mean, though... The host of Ingolfin has livestock. They at least have horses. Like, we know for a fact that they have horses that they brought with them from Valinor. And they would almost certainly have other livestock that they would bring with them, right? Because although, you know, they packed in a hurry when they left, it's not like they left without any thought, right? I mean, Feanor was trying to hustle them along and not give them time to have second thoughts, so they had to pack quickly, and he told them to pack light. But they're still moving. You know, this is not, they're not going on a spontaneous day trip. They're relocating to Middle Earth, and so they're not going to take no thought, you know, for how they will support themselves and stuff. So, assuming there are domesticated animals among the Noldor, which we know they have horses. Would they have cows, goats, sheep? They might do. Possibly.
You know, for a film series that was filmed in New Zealand, it's kind of surprising how little sheep there are in the Lord of the Rings movie.
That's true. Shockingly small number of sheep. Yes, yes. My elder son was particularly disappointed by that. And for exactly the same reason, like New Zealand, like sheep capital of the world, and almost no sheep. In fact, is there ever a sheep? Do we get a single sheep shot anywhere?
The Shire, probably,
the Shire?
If anywhere.
Sheep in the distance?
I don't know. I'm just guessing. Yeah. It seems like I remember there were, like, pigs.
Yeah, we got pigs.
Because they were very big pigs.
Yes, yes.
Because the hobbits
are pigs.
I'm not big. I don't remember their sheep, though.
That is shocking in retrospect. I didn't think
And then
the
you
time.
Get places like Iceland where there's nothing but sheep as well.
Right.
And we're in a more Icelandy area in this part of the story.
Right.
Of course, they're brought there.
Yeah.
But non-natives, but yeah.
Yeah. Let's see. Timothy, I don't think they would have had... Well, so Timothy is raising the question of wagons. Would there be wains? Would the Noldor have a wagon train? Not all of... So only the Feanorians leave Valinor in ships, right? Most of them are still on land the whole time. So they would presumably, right? Leave Valinor with wagons. Like they'd have some.
Well, this is the question that I have is that they're all kind of expecting to go on the ships and then they don't. And so did they go back to get more stuff before they left?
They can never go back. They can never go back. So they definitely can't go back, but their expectation would have been that there would have been trips, right? They would have ferried stuff and they would have been able to whether they take the actual wagons or whether they unload the wagons and leave the wagons behind or whether they're able to disassemble the wagons and bring, I mean, remember we're immortal, right? So like we can take lots of trips. Like we can take time with this, you know, they wouldn't be in a hurry in that sense. So clearly the presumption, once the ships were acquired, the presumption was, we're gonna all get ferried. All us and all of our stuff are all gonna get ferried across. It may take a bunch of trips, but that's okay. It's only then when they're abandoned that they realize that they have to go over. Håkon, that's what I'm thinking too.
Finrod is carrying a big bag of jewels the whole time.
Right. Yeah. Exactly.
Didn't he bring a bunch?
Right. He did.
He doesn't drop them ever. He doesn't set them down. He carries them the whole way.
Exactly. I have to admit that I'm pretty sure that in my younger years, reading the Silmarillion, there was a point when I realized that I had the visual image of Finrod with like a huge backpack, chocked full of gems from Valinor. But the more actually thinking that through, that seems really unlikely, right? He would have brought wagons. Surely they would have brought wagons. They need supplies anyway. So I've got to think that the Noldor left Tirion with a wagon train, and then that wagon train has been going up the coast again with the expectation that it or at least its cargo would have been ferried across in the ships once those had been acquired. But because remember, they didn't know about the Helcaraxa. Like that is, they knew that there was a way. They knew that like Orome rode Nahara across to Middle-earth, so they knew there was a land bridge to Middle-earth, but they didn't know what it was like.
They don't need wagons either. They could have stolen small boats from the Teleri since they were already stealing boats anyways, and they could, I mean, they walked along shore the whole time.
Right.
They could maybe have, like, on sticks or leads and walk with them.
They could. Well, it's two things. The reason
I don't know how that would work with shoreline, though.
Right. Well, exactly. The two reasons I suggest wagon train is that, number one, we know for a fact that it says that they went up the coast. So we know that not all of them were on the sea, like that was not plan A. And moreover, it's Feanor's plan to take the ships of the Teleri. I got to think that Fingolfin and certainly Finarfin, whose wife was Teleri, I cannot imagine that Finarfin left Tirion with the assumption that, you know, the Teleri were going to supply them boats. He would know what the ships of the Teleri meant and how unlikely it was that they were going to join in, and certainly how impossible it was that they were just going to give them their ships. So I have to think that even the majority of the Noldor who left Tirion were not planning for a sea voyage at all. Like, that wasn't on their radar screen. That was Feanor's idea, right, that he was going to facilitate their trip by getting ships and by trying to to swell their numbers by trying to recruit the Teleri and to facilitate their travel, their crossing, by getting ships. But I can't think that Fingolfin, or especially Finarfin, that that was plan A for them. I got to think that was totally unforeseen by them, which means if they left Tirion before Feanor even revealed the idea that he was going to approach the Teleri, I've got to think they, when they, you know, on the moment that they step out of Tirion, they're assuming they're doing a land journey. So I got to think.
I think we've just answered our question.
Yeah.
They're prepared, but grossly unprepared for the Helcaraxa.
For the Helcaraxa, right. So they would have to, if they did have wagons, they would have to convert, you know, to sledges and stuff like that, you know, which they could do. I mean, they would adapt in that way. So we could see.
Burn the wheels for heat.
Burn the wheels, exactly. Right. Oh, well, fortunately, we now, the positive side is we now have all this fuel. Yeah. So I would think that they would have stuff. Now, Nick was asking, are the elves not big fans of wheels? Well,
there was a discussion about that,
yeah.
But I don't remember exactly what forum it was in or who was part of it. I apologize. Right.
Nick is suggesting pack animals rather than wagons.
Okay, but... Okay, here's the thing. Maybe because people think wheels and they think dwarves because it's mechanical. Well, I mean, the wheel has been around for so long. It's one of the earliest inventions. It's kind of ridiculous to think that the elves wouldn't use wheels.
Yeah.
And this is my main argument, that they would definitely be using wheels, but maybe not in the way people are thinking. They built all those towers. They had pulley systems.
They had pulleys.
Don't tell me they didn't. Yeah.
Clearly. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
No, the idea of elves never using pulleys and things like that is, or, you know, not using the wheel as simple tool, you know, it would almost be like imagining them not.
They did all that
levers.
Weaving too. So much weaving, yeah. Though maybe that was less of the wheel and more of that square thing that I don't know the name of.
Yeah. That depends on what kind of loom you're talking about, whether there's lots
of
wheels.
Yeah, I was like, a loom.
I'm trying to remember, does Tolkien explicitly say that they don't use wheels? I mean, that they choose to use wheeled vehicles. I mean, like, so to say elves don't like riding in carriages, you know, is...
That just means they prefer riding horses versus sitting
in
a box.
That doesn't, to me, say that they would not use a wagon. To
Beleriand's not really famous for its roads, I would think.
Right.
So, and I think there's a distinction to be made between wheels and gears.
Right.
Yeah. You know?
Yes, gears.
So,
exactly.
If you have
When Saruman is described as a mind of metal and wheels, it's gears, I think, specifically that are being evoked there, not round wheeled conveyances necessarily. I mean, it's clear, for instance, that, you know, in Gondor they use wheeled vehicles, right? They have wagons and everything, and that's not evil per se or a sign of their decline. I agree. Gears. That's the big thing, and that's always what I have believed that Tolkien is referring to with the mind of metal and wheels. You know, Saruman getting some of his precious machinery working, right? It's the machinery, it's the gears, it's the engines. That's what's sort of morally questionable, right? But I can't imagine
industrial side of it.
Yes.
Not like a mill.
Yes.
Today, bread.
Gandalf drives a cart, right? I mean, you know, into
See, into Gandalf the Shire. Approved.
Yeah. Gandalf carts are Gandalf approved. Yeah, I don't think yes, by preference. Again, no, elves are not going to ride in like 18th century carriages, right? But that doesn't mean they don't use wheels.
And even Gandalf has a preference to ride. I mean, Shadowfax, he just brought a wagon because he had all his firewood.
Because he's got stuff, right?
So,
presumably when elves have
all this
stuff. Yeah. But the road thing is a really good point, though. I mean, if you know that you're setting off across rough terrain, even if you don't anticipate the Helcaraxa, right? Nobody expects the Helcaraxa. But even if you don't expect the Helcaraxa, I mean, they can't be imagining that the, you know, quite possibly mountainous land alongside the coast up the, you know, up the coast of Ahriman is going to be necessarily convenient for carts. So I definitely would, the more I think about that, the more I think actually it would be more practical to bring more pack animals than wagons because no roads.
Well, how often did they have to move stuff in Valinor as well? So they probably just have the animals already.
Yeah, no,
but
exactly.
They would
have to have them, yeah.
That this is all good. Maybe we should go to the next slide.
That's a great plan.
I think it's time someone said it.
That's a great plan. Okay. All right, the Sindar. Let's move on to the Sindar. Okay, so you had lots of trees and nature stuff here.
So the thing I wanted to do with the Sindar and the Nandor was think about a different sort of aesthetic that they could have.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of historical Western dress is all about the waist and the bust and the shoulders. Like, okay. There's a lot of emphasis on bringing things in at the waist. And I wanted them to not have that aesthetic. Okay. Okay. So to sort of be more interested in the shape of the garment and an overall shape than the shape of the body necessarily.
Okay.
So I had this idea of, so there's two hanboks that I have. Hanboks are traditional Korean dress. This one, if you look at it, it's the top right picture.
Right.
Is very triangular. Like, just squint your eyes. Don't look at the details.
Mm-hmm.
Just look at the shape and how triangular it is.
Right.
And I thought that could sort of evoke a hill with flowers and trees and stuff on it, and they would put a lot of natural materials onto their garments. So I have a little sketch I did of Melian on the bottom right, and then Bree found some pictures of fashion that has natural themes incorporated into it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But that sort of shape would be more their sort of ceremonial or courtly dress. Mostly you would see the Sindar in very practical clothing, but I still want to have that aesthetic of not accentuating the body necessarily, but accentuating this sort of triangular shape.
Right. But not triangular in the evil sense.
Right. Yes, it would be an upside. It would be a pyramid rather than an upside down triangle.
Or sort of bell-like rather than...
And honestly, the shape is less triangular, more of like a little... It's like an elongated circle in some ways.
Yeah.
It's not pointy at the top, really.
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, this is not a threatening look.
No, that's not a threatening look. Yeah. I totally agree.
And then Myth Lewin also mentioned, it's in the notes here on this slide, that their court and ceremonial dress would become a lot more elaborate as they established Menegroth.
Right.
So you can kind of imagine this kind of shape that I'm trying to portray, this sort of triangular pyramidal shape that I'm trying to establish, have that shape continuing through, but becoming more elaborate as you get to Menegroth. So the earlier versions of it would be pretty simple or rough-ish, because I don't think they have metal yet. I remember that. And then when they get to Menegroth and they're interacting with the dwarves, it would become finer and more elaborate because they have like a spot that they can live.
And they wouldn't be...
I mean, they have other people make metal things for them.
Right.
So most of their stuff wouldn't be...
Right.
Yeah. Right. Also, like, this stuff is all more Eastern ideas versus Western ideas, which makes sense because they're the Eastern elves versus Valinor.
Exactly. And they also would have no gems at all until they interacted with the dwarves, right? So we could start introducing some gems into their, I'm thinking about like how the manifestation of the more elaborate court dress. I mean, I hear what you're saying about metal tools and so therefore more elaborately sort of shaped clothing. The decorations, my quick thought here was flowers, right? I would think, given like flowers spring up under Luthien's feet as she dances, right? And flowers are associated with both Melian and with Luthien. So I would think that the Sindarin clothing would be the most heavily flowery, right, of all of them?
Yep. And yeah, that bottom left-hand picture is very good for that.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
But go ahead, Bree.
It's like we have a shape and we're putting a bunch of stuff on it. Right. So like stuff they find, like that has, do you think that has naturally fallen off the trees anyways?
Right. Right.
So they probably would work a lot of wood instead of metal in terms of making like more like a bracelet-y stuff like that that's traditionally made with like metal works, but
yes,
they just do it with branches and stuff. And then you think maybe pinning leaves and flowers. And like we got this Melian look here, but I also always have this other Melian look. She's probably has multiple outfits. She's a queen,
right?
But like black feathers and stuff, because you got the whole Nightingale thing, and it kind of foreshadows Lucien's hair cloak later, which probably looks similar to like feather cloaks, anyways, even though it's hair.
And
so, just pinning a bunch of different things.
About feathers is you don't have to use actual feathers to evoke feathers,
mm-hmm.
right? So you can make a fabric that. And sort of, or make pieces and put them together so that they overlap and look like feathers. So yes, they could be picking stuff up off the ground, but they could also be making their fabrics and their textiles in such a way that they look like what they see on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah, exactly. On that subject also, Nick was suggesting bone and antler as other things that could be used for decorations.
Oh yeah. I mean, these lead to like the Mirkwood elves, and you got the whole like deer thing and the hunt theme going on with them. So, yeah, so they came directly from Doriath, so
right.
It makes sense that we have been to that.
Yeah, definitely. No, that's great. And do we have the green elves next? No, we're so more Sindar. Okay, all right. Oh, cool.
Because there's so many different types of Sindar.
Right, exactly.
Really
so these drawings that you have on the right here, these are the Philothrim specifically?
Yeah, the one on the left is something I never finished, but we just kind of threw it in here last minute. Okay. This is more Círdan in the Philothrim. So mainly thinking of like drapey shapes to evoke water, but then we have a lot of I did more like scale mail stuff, but I was trying to evoke more like pebbles on a beach, like shells, that sort of image. So I'd probably have, like a lot of patterns and stuff. And then blue. And I tend to draw Teleri in general as dark skinned because the other elves aren't, but also I give them white hair. And it's probably, I know the reason why I do this, and it's because of the Atlantis Disney movie. I grew up with it. And you know, like, it's a water, culture, Mediterranean culture. You get the whole Atlantis thing. So I also think of the Teleri as, like, has Mediterranean elements, like medieval stuff, just because they have to deal with the ocean.
Right.
And they're fishermen. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I've been influenced by Disney movies from birth, so what are you going to do?
Exactly. Well, and, you know, one of the things that we were really emphasizing in thinking about their culture and about their outlook, one of the things that we were going to even differentiating them from the Sindar is that they're really like, they see their ships as their primary thing. Like the whole scene that we have where their cities are being overrun and destroyed, and they don't care, right? Like they've saved their people and they've saved their ships, and so like that's, you know, rebuilding the city is not really a big deal, and you know, they're not particularly bothered by losing it. So I would think, even kind of reflecting that, having a lot of their clothing be essentially like clothing that, you know, designed to be worn on ships, you know, when you're fishing or sailing or whatever. You know, that would be really dominant, as if like, again, like being on a boat is their like home state, right?
I also sort of imagined the bathroom as keeping sort of a similar shape to where they had been at the end of season two, like the ones who didn't go across the water.
Right, right.
So I have I think the pictures that I drew are up on, are not in this slide, but are in this PowerPoint, but they're up on the forums of where they got to before they went over the sea. And it's pretty, they're pretty simple shapes, like lots of rectangles sewn together and that sort of thing.
Right.
I think I remember seeing them a while back. Yeah, rectangles, though. I don't know. Maybe it's because they're, like, a constant. Like, keratin's a constant, and squares are, like, these strong, solid, kind of immovable thing. But we get, like, more... But they're still rounded edges, because they're, like, a consistent, like, like, moral center.
Right.
Like, keratin's never, like, never loses his way.
Right. Right, exactly. No, you're certainly, you're certainly right that if there's one... If there's one constant in Middle Earth, it's got to be keratin, right? Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, cool.
To contrast them with, like, northern Sindar, like the Sindar who would probably be up in Hiflum before they leave because they're like, what are all these men doing here? I don't know why. I tend to picture, like, Hiflum and, like, Mithram as being snowy, but... Mm. Having trees with red leaves, I don't know why. So I tend to, I was kind of made them a little different by giving them elements of red, and maybe because they're close to Angband or something. Right. But mainly though, I was trying to make them a little more Eastern in design,
right?
Just to give variety. But I haven't developed them nearly as much as the others, hence why this is an unfinished thing from like 3 years ago that year.
Sure, sure, yeah, cool. Cool. Well, let's kind of bring in the Green Elves here and think about the Nandor, who are again connected, but more separated. It seems like even the way that we were talking about it through the episodes, it rather seemed like the Green Elves had kind of were culturally differentiated from the Sindar even more, really, than the Sindar were from, say, the Teleri of Alqualondë. So tell me some about the elements that you're thinking of here in these in some of these pictures.
So for the Nandor, I have a handbook again, but I don't want you to look at the details again. I want you to look at the shape and see how it's very columnar. Am I just putting the right emphasis?
Yeah.
Columnar?
Huh.
Anyway, you know what I mean.
I do. Like a column. Yeah.
Yes. So very straight up and down like a tree trunk.
Right.
And then they have these beautiful headdresses that you can see at the bottom here because they're sort of looking up at the Ents.
Right.
And they want their faces to be surrounded by beauty while they're talking to the Ents. You know what I mean?
Right. And actually making themselves tree-like in a sense, right? Like emulating
Exactly.
Also, it kind of evokes the whole guerrilla warfare, which I think they'd be the most likely to do. I mean, you think of them as more camouflaged.
Right.
And hidden in the trees.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so their body garments would be a lot more simple than their headdresses would be. Like, if you looked at them straight on, there'd be kind of a disconnect between what you see on their top half and what you see on their bottom half.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. Which is, again, tree-like, right? Like, you've got the, you know, the plain trunk and then the, whether it's leaves or blossoms, you know, all of the fancy bits are at the top, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Interesting.
And so, I just wanted to mention these headdresses at the bottom are Ukrainian and Polish artists trying to bring back their culture. And if you want to look at the actual source material, I can post that on the forums just so we're not taking the artist's work without credit.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I could see them, as you say, like it's not, just like trees don't wear blossoms all year round, they're not going to be wearing bright colored stuff all year, you know, like, you know, blossomy stuff all year round. And a lot of times they would be very camouflaged you know, I would think a lot of their day-to-day dress would be, even if they had headdresses, not, again, not resplendent and gorgeous all the time, but they would have those, right? They would do that. They would, you know, that would be something that we could see them doing on sort of special occasions. In fact,
and they're the green elves, and therefore most likely for us to dress them up in actual things that look like green leaves.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, right.
And they'd probably use what was in season for their clothing. Like, their clothing would be very seasonal in that sense.
Yes. Yes.
Like, they would use fresh flowers, and those fresh flowers would die, so then they'd have to make something new, right?
Right, right. And they would be dressing in leaves as often, or more often, probably, than they would be dressing in blossoms or flowers.
Or even just fabric that's cut to look like leaves. It doesn't have to actually be. I mean, they're not super primitive.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, they would be, at least to the point of knowing how to make fabric, because they already knew how to make fabric at Quivienin. So.
Right, right. Right, exactly. And they, I was just thinking of the, you know, them having both a fancy dress that they do don on fancy occasions, and then the more sort of practical and camouflage oriented clothing that they would usually wear. I'm thinking of some of the scenes that we had between them, and it would be really interesting to have them dress up. Like, so they're in their fancy dress when they meet, when they meet Mablung and Thingol, right? When they're talking to the Grey Elves, they would dress up in their fancy dress. But when they're talking to the dwarves, they would dress in their like camouflage battle gear, basically. It would be an interesting way to kind of signal the Green Elf attitude, right? Exactly kind of where they're thinking and what their opinion is, just by what they show up dressed in.
Also, the use of natural materials in a scene where you have the Elves of Doriv and the Green Elves speaking to each other, you see that there is a visual relationship between them because they're doing similar things, but the Green Elves are just doing more of it.
Yeah, yeah.
To a much more extreme degree.
Yeah, exactly. Now, Tony asks, you know, the very sensible question, would they be using living plant stuff if they're interacting with Ents? I would say yes. But of course, this is
trees where drop things all the
trees
time.
Trees drop things all the time. Exactly. Yeah. No, I would think that would be.
I mean,
Treebeard says
that. I think. Yeah.
Right. Right. And even thinking about how Quickbeam was not offended, of course, by birds taking fruit off the rowan trees, but he was offended by them taking the fruit off the trees and casting it down and not eating it. Right. So that kind of. You know, the trees and the plants give and you use and share and have, but it's you know, they're not going to be, like, very few plants are going to be, you know, seriously damaged or harmed in the making of their garments, which brings up a really interesting point, of course, about the Nandor, is that we have one challenge already in that they don't have metal tools. We have another challenge in that I don't think they're going to necessarily have that much in the way of wooden tools either. They're not going to use a whole lot of wood. They could use wood that, I mean, they can use wood that's dropped in things, but they're not going to have wooden structures. They're not going to have, I mean, this. Their use of wood would be limited because that they wouldn't do. They wouldn't cut down trees for wood.
They'd probably do more weaving.
Yeah, so
you can do a lot of embroidery needlework with
bigger thing.
Yeah, yeah.
With bone tools. Right?
Yes, yes.
And bones and antlers fall to the ground all the time.
Exactly. Like, yeah. Yeah.
Well,
agreed.
Not all the time, but.
Agree. No, that's definitely true. So a lot of their tools, I would think, would be bone and antler.
Also, stone tools.
And stone, yes.
Also that.
Yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah, also that. But I would think, because, I mean, even, you know, when you think about leaves and stuff, even if you're taking leaves off of a living tree, it's not like, what's Quickbeam's, line, and the rowan has plenty and to spare, right? I don't think that Treebeard would grudge, you know, like a burst of leaves, you know, for them to like take off of a living tree, even to like, I don't think that elves would be against that. Like, they would, you know, it would be done with respect and living together and stuff. But
they'd be very careful not to kill the plant that they're harvesting from.
Exactly. I mean, that can be done.
Also, as someone who lives in the woods, I like literally live in the woods. I'm surrounded by trees right now. They're falling down all the time.
Right, exactly.
It's
kind of
terrifying.
The trees, you mean, yes.
Oh, no.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So, no, I mean, there's lots of opportunity for that. But, yeah, I don't think that we need to... We just would be careful. You know, when Tony's asking about living flowers... You know, I don't know. Even that, first of all, would Treebeard be equally protective of, you know, grasses and flowers as he is of trees? I'm not really even sure. You know, would a flower that grows and then is, you know, sort of taken and used as decoration, you know, is that an abuse of the flower?
I think there's any way for her. You know, and to walk to the woods without damaging everything he's walking on.
Exactly.
Not like there's going to be an empty path.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
It could be also made very clear that they will never pick a flower where it only has one flower per plant.
Right.
Like they'd only pick flowers from plants that make multiple blooms so that they can leave some so that that plant can then have seeds and continue itself.
We can, you know, if we apply, you know, the sort of the general principle, right, that they are sensitive to the lives of plants and, you know, interested in working together with plants and not simply, you know, subjugating plants or you know, killing plants. But yes, so I definitely think it is a line that we can walk without having to worry about that too much. And yes, I agree, Marielle, Yovana does seem more protective of the living things that take a long time to grow. Like I said, I'm not sure that a flower that blooms and I mean, like, I think of things like tulips and stuff like that.
It'll be dead in a week.
Exactly. Tulip, a bulb flower, right? Which, you know, the bulb, you know, lives and flowers year by year. But yeah, I mean, those flowers don't last very long. And to sort of take and preserve them for as long as possible and to display them as widely as possible, not sure that that's an abuse, ultimately, you know, of the plant. And it certainly doesn't kill it in the sense of, you know, with any kind of permanence, right? It's just sort of harvesting the flower when it comes. I mean, they would need to.
They're not ripping it up by the root.
Exactly. Exactly.
It's just like taking an apple from a tree.
Right. Which, again, you know, Quick Beam is explicitly in favor of, right? So, yeah. So I think that we can definitely work with that. Cool.
Let's talk about dwarves.
Let's talk about dwarves.
Yeah.
Agreed. Okay. All right. Let's talk about dwarves. Okay. So we have the two different families of dwarves that we're focusing on in this season, right? The dwarves of Belagost and the dwarves of Nogrod. Mm. So you guys were working with the kind of the cultural principles, right? So we had the dwarves of Nogrod being primarily the jewelers and those of Belagost being into weapons and armor in particular.
Yeah. Apparently that was a discussion that happened in the forums.
On the
these pictures are specifically by Herangil. Mm-hmm. So is that person on the chat right now? Can they speak to their work?
I don't think so.
I think they were trying to establish cultural baselines for each group, though.
Right.
And also a visual consistency between all of them. Because really the dwarves are an opportunity to do something very different.
Right.
I mean, dwarves technically have a base image in all our minds. I mean, I think the way they did Gimli in the movies is kind of typical of what people think of dwarves anyways, even before that movie came out.
Right.
I don't think people thought of, like, the Disney Snow White version. We don't have to make them look like the elves, and we shouldn't. But we kind of used up a lot of cultural bases from our own world on the elves already. So it's like, well, what hasn't been done?
Right.
So I think pulling from other things will visually make them different and more interesting, but we can still use these base images that are kind of embedded into our culture.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think people think of dwarves like I was saying before I got distracted, like the Snow White dwarves. People don't think of those dwarves as the same as like D&D style, Tolkien style dwarves. They're like two right. different things, just like people distinguish between different types of fairies. It's like Tinkerbell fairies and there's other fairies.
Right.
I think
right.
people do naturally distinguish them based on context, and they're not just one sole version.
I have the forum up right now where Herangil posted these.
Mm-hmm.
So the bottom, let me just, the bottom picture, I don't know if you can read it. It's petty dwarves on the left, broad beams in the middle, and fire beards. And the comment on
the
it
ones
is,
appearing in this movie.
Yeah. and the comments on it were that the early dwarves would be more practical. This is Herangil. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correctly. I hope I am. And then they don't become, they don't get fancy until they start trading with other people.
Right.
And then the picture on the right, the from top to bottom, it's broad beams on the left, long beards on the right, black locks on the left, iron fists on the right, stiff beards on the left, stone foots on the right. Mm-hmm. And then, so the comments for the stiff beards were that they were northern or Siberian.
Okay.
It is to evoke their cold environment. The iron fists would be sell swords and traders in metals and vaguely Sarmatian or Hun. The black locks would be darker hair and complexion, like pre-Aryan Indian tribes, and the Stonefoots would be Stoic miners with sort of ancient Chinese cultural references in there.
Okay.
So that's Herangil's sort
that's
of
interesting. Yeah, that's interesting.
Ideas. Yeah, I sort of did the same thing as him, but like separately. Mm-hmm. And like, we didn't see each other's work because I wasn't on the forums, and no one's seen what's on the next slide until we get to there. I literally finished it yesterday. but it's weird because there's some similarities. Because I always like looking at how art from books, especially the Silmarillion, is developed separately, and then how it somehow looks the same when it's together, right. even though there's no information in the book. It's like how everyone pictures Smaug the same, except for the animated one, which will never make any sense.
Never.
But, never make any sense. Just like, yeah. So, yeah, I noticed some things that are like, maybe it's just something to do with the words. Like, we only have, like, one word for a lot of these cultures, and yet that sort of evokes certain things, maybe right. because it's like, well, it can't be like the traditional Scandinavian dwarf, which are the long beards. So how does this word in that context of that known dwarf,
right.
like, what does that culturally make you think of? So there's a bunch of differences, but I was like, oh, hey, there's some similar ideas here.
Right. Now, Karita was pointing out, and this is also something that I found very striking here. Herangil has imagined the dwarf women as veiled. That seems very interesting to me.
I remember talking to Mithluin about this when we went over kind of the ideas, and mm-hmm. I think that idea came about because the hosts, you were very wishy-washy about dwarf women having beards.
Yes. Your beards are too beautiful to be seen. anyone.
And so the compromise was having them be veiled, and I am very against that idea.
I'm very for
dwarf women with beards.
Okay.
So I think that was kind of Herangil's idea to show sort of that compromise in a visual form.
It was because he really wanted them to have beards too, but he was just pretending they did. He was just hiding them from you. I guess.
Yeah.
The idea that dwarf women's beards are just too beautiful for public viewing is kind of interesting, actually.
I have lots of problems with that idea.
I understand. and I think, is it the next slide that you guys are making your pitch for beards?
Yeah. But before we go to the next slide,
no,
I just wanted to...
Not yet,
okay.
I think the slide after the next one.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
But before we go to that, there was a bit of a discussion about the dwarves of Belagost being the armor makers and the dwarves of Nograd being the jewelry makers.
Mm-hmm.
And while I was talking to Mithluin about this, I mentioned, and I haven't been able to find the reference again, but there is a particular period in history where it was either the French or the English. Mm-hmm. They put up tariffs on imported cloth so that they would promote their own sort of textile makers.
Right.
And what ended up happening is that their local textile makers were not very good. Right. They were only good at ribbons. So the clothing of that particular period has a ton of ribbons all over it because of this political...
Wait, this might explain a painting period that I'm thinking of right now. Like, usually I'm like, I have like the weird art history and she has the fashion thing. I'm like, wait, these are the same thing.
A lot of our fashion history from art history.
Yeah.
Right, I have to say.
Talking about this.
Yeah. So then the dwarves of Belagos, because they're good at making armor, their clothing would then be reminiscent of armor.
Right.
And the dwarves of Nagrod, because they're good at making jewelry, their clothing would then be reminiscent of jewelry or feature jewelry in a more
Nagrod is in a cave, if I remember. I get the details mixed up because I mixed my notes up when I was working on dwarves the past 6 months, and I was just like, oh no, I mixed them up. But I think Nagrod is in a cave, though. I was thinking of how like crystals naturally form in a cave, right. So you get more like jewel stuff anyways just from their environment versus Belagos is more on a mountain and coming up at the peaks and coming out and being more stone anyways.
Right. So one really basic question. What is dwarf clothing made of? What kind of fabrics do dwarves have? What would they mostly wear?
I think people tend to, with the dwarves and the elves, they get these weird ideas in their head, especially in the last 15 years or so. Mm-hmm. It's like how the elves are randomly vegetarians now, but there's no evidence of them being that. Like, you get that like
lots
in the movie,
and
like, that doesn't really make sense.
Yeah.
And it's like, the dwarves must not live outside. I'm like, the dwarves lived on their own for a long time. Yeah, the dwarves of Erebor relied on the men to get their food because they happened to be there, and that was a fluke, and it was a nice little community, and you get that a few times. But the dwarves existed by themselves. They had to have had livestock. They had to have farming. They weren't completely subterranean.
Right.
But I can see them having more emphasis on leathers because there is this kind of idea that dwarves are less caring of the natural world.
Yeah, yes. They definitely.
More leather. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, so like Bree was saying, they'd have sort of the same kinds of fabrics that other people's would have. They might make them a little differently. But aside from having maybe more leather, I can't see them having a huge difference in the particular fibers that they would be making their clothing out of. You know what I mean?
Maybe they'd be more inclined to have thicker fabrics just because they're thicker people. So instead of silks, you get wools and more stiff fabric, maybe like that, just creating like a feeling, like the way it would feel like if you're touching it, or just even the way you're seeing it.
Right.
And another interesting way. Another interesting thing that I thought of is that caves in general are cold. However, when you get close to, like, when you get subterranean, closer to the middle of the earth, it gets warm.
Right.
So maybe there would be like a differentiation between the dwarves living in caves that are cold and the dwarves living in deep caves that are warmer.
Right.
But
I think I was naturally doing that. But I think I was also imagining the Belagos dwarves as like, since they're not in a cave, maybe they'd be like having watchtowers if they're at the top of the mountain. So it's cold up in those mountains. Right. I guess I don't know.
Right.
Like you just get these weird like ideas in your head. You're like, why am I even thinking that? I don't know. Where that idea came from, and it's probably some weird sentence you read in the book 5 years ago and you don't remember reading it. It's just stuck in your head.
I agree. I mean, thinking about different altitudes, not just Anastasia, as you were suggesting, subterranean altitudes or sub-altitudes or however you describe that. some dwarves would live up in the mountains, and so you would have some that would be exposed to cold and you know, underground, you know, even if most of your underground works are up in the mountains, it's still going to be fairly cold up there, right, compared to...
Plus, underground, it's crowded down there. There's a lot of sweaty dwarves, all of that body heat.
And forges and things like that.
Up.
Yeah.
Oh, exactly. Yeah, the forges, too.
Yeah, so... Absolutely, that throws quite a bit of heat. One can imagine it was I was just doing a bunch of historical stuff, and my younger son loves blacksmiths. He loves watching the blacksmiths. So every time we were at historical places in Southern Virginia over the last week, I did a lot of standing somewhat near blacksmith forges. And I can imagine if that were in an enclosed space, like underground in a cave, that would warm quite a bit around it.
I definitely think you should foster this desire in your child to be a blacksmith.
Yes. Yeah. Agreed. That would be cool. That'd be handy. So awesome.
Should we?
Yep.
Let us. Next slide.
Let us. Yes. Okay. So Brie, here's some of your dwarf stuff.
I didn't really like. I started drawing some of this back around December, and then I stopped working on it, and then I tried working on it this week, and I didn't really finish. But this is as close as it's going to be for today.
Cool.
I tend to have the same creative impulses as Tolkien, the fact that if I don't like something, I won't just throw it away. I'll just keep drawing on top of it until it's good.
Right.
So I need to draw on top of it some more. I was mainly trying to think of different ethnicities and how the dwarves are all spaced out and based on how they migrated, how they intermingled. Longbeards, I mean, they're Scandinavian looking. I use a lot of Scandinavian culture, more the Nordic, not like the indigenous people.
Right.
I tried to use more indigenous northern looks and more like Hun style looks for Belagos, just because I was thinking like broad and thick, and you think of those people as the bronze because of how they're depicted usually in movies, but also because they were just wearing a lot of clothing.
Right. Okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And then I had the Firebeards more, like, I gave them hammers and things as their weapons because we were thinking of them forging, even though they're the jewel people, but I didn't really, I don't know, I just felt like it worked with them. I thought of them having, like, dual hammers. The Broadbeans, I have that axe there, but I'm not really married to it. I don't really like it. Okay. But I was more thinking of them having big, squarish, Roman-styled shields.
Yes.
I like they were that. A little more dwarven-looking with their masks, because I just think of them being just as, like, the Romans would just make walls as they marched, and I think that's the only way they could have dealt with Glaurung. I think that's how it's kind of described them.
Yes.
Doing at the Battle of Unnumbered Tears, in addition to the masks, I mean, they would have had to just be this giant shield. So squares, square shapes again, just to make them a giant wall together.
Yeah, I really like the tower shield concept for Belgast. And now the other thing, of course, one of the sort of famously distinctive elements of dwarf armor that Tolkien mentions is chainmail, right? He alludes explicitly to dwarves as the inventors of chainmail. Were you thinking of having that be explicitly a Belagost thing? Belagost as the inventors of chainmail?
I was associating it more with them. I was thinking it more of them. It's probably just because we see them in like a battle versus the Firebeards, we just kind of see them murdering elf kings.
Right. Yeah, that's the only time we see them fighting is when they're at war with Doriath.
Yeah, really. So I do think of one being more military watchtower-esque
versus
one more, like, craftsman-esque.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, you get the Firebeards, you think of forges as well. So
yeah.
So just continue, like, flame wave thing versus the square thing. The other ones, besides, like, the main three we actually see in the stories, I just sort of made up. whatever. So they're not as important because they're not ever shown, but just, like, you go over them quickly. Blacklocks, I mean, we get the word black, so I was thinking more darker complexion, but I was also thinking lock, like lockpicking, mechanical devices, D&D rogue.
Right.
So that sort of
idea.
More buckles and little parts, and they probably have more tools. Iron fists, I was thinking of, like, Turkish wrestlers for some reason, and I just gave them, like, iron gloves. Stiff beards, I was thinking of how thick East Asian hair is, and maybe you could make some, like, stiff beards out of that.
Mm-hmm.
Material of hair doesn't really make sense, but that, like, hair is different than, like, Western hair, which is not as, like, stiff.
Right.
So I was thinking of Jade Empire stuff because I thought, oh, well, carving jade stuff because dwarven art. And then I did something similar with the Iron Foots, who ended up being more Inca and Aztec stuff, because I was thinking of the stone carvings there, but how they're also mountain people naturally that exist in our world. So I was doing stuff like that.
Right. Cool. Yeah, I like it.
I'm probably going to draw over all of this stuff, though.
I really like the Novgorod and Belga stuff here. Like I said, I'm a huge fan of the Tower Shield thing. I agree. Thinking of a bunch of, you know, ranks of dwarves of Belagost with their tower shields and their masks standing up to Glaurung, that's really perfect, because you're right, that would be a way to make them very distinctive in their ability to resist the dragon and dragon fire. You can imagine, you know, Glaurung's fire just sort of sweeping, you know, whooshing over their shields and masks and you know, and not really touching any of them.
Really, have you ever seen the animated movie Secret of Kells?
I don't think so.
Maybe it's 2D.
I've heard of it.
It's by this Irish studio. They've made up like 3 movies now. On the way they show the Vikings coming in to invade these Irish settlements is they're just giant squares, and the movie's more does more shape language and less realism. So when they're marching together, just a giant rectangle thing coming towards everyone. It's taking the whole screen. It's just this black square, and you can see sort of Viking horns on top of it, but it's, I don't know, it's pretty good.
Right, cool.
In terms of design.
Yeah, cool. Cool. All right. Awesome. Well, we're starting to run out of time, so we should move forward here. This is the appeal for bearded dwarf women.
Do you like this passive aggressive slide?
Yeah,
I think it's pretty great.
This is a very great passive aggressive slide. Okay. So if like there is a very general movement for dwarf bearded women, I'm not going to resist it until the end. I'm not massively anti bearded dwarf women. Mostly I just kind of dislike the kind of joking stereotype of it, you know, I wouldn't want to play it for laughs.
No, I don't think so.
And those
absolutely
are,
not.
Yeah.
They would receive the same amount of respect as any other character on the show.
Yeah.
Like, if you just write them as this is a normal thing, then people won't joke about it.
Right. Right.
Yeah. There were some in, like, the concept art book of the Hobbit movies, and I remember, like, the internet found them, and they freaked out about them, like, in a good way. But I felt like they were kind of weak. I mean, they were kind of, like, really, they weren't very great beards. They were just kind of, like, these wispy things that was, like, that's not even designed for, like, if,
right.
Like, if you had a beard, like, you didn't really do anything with your beard. Just kind of sitting there. I don't know.
Would you
do more than that?
Would there be a distinction? What would be the distinction? Or would there be any? Would dwarf women and dwarf men, in fact, look exactly alike? Would they be mostly indistinguishable? Would there be, you know, would... Essentially, among dwarves, then, would we speculate that facial hair is any part of secondary sexual characteristics in dwarves, or just not? They'd be the same.
I think they would wear it slightly differently.
So
they'd wear it differently, but it would grow similar.
It would grow the same. Okay, right.
Yeah.
So we're just imagining.
I also
think
there would probably be naturally less hair still. I mean, because you have not as like thin and wispy as I was talking about before.
Right.
But
right.
Think of how long the beards are supposed to be on the males.
Right.
They're supposed to be way longer than we ever saw in the movies.
Right.
So,
well,
like,
especially for the
just
long
the normal
beards. Yeah.
Human beard would look.
Yeah.
Better than what we got, and it would still be less. So I think like just. Designing it with female shapes and, like, the women still physically, I think, look very similar to the men in dwarves. But there's still subtle things you can do in the shapes to make them just, like, you can still tell it's a woman. But maybe if they're in war together, you might not tell right away, which is kind of the feeling we get from the text anyways, that we might have seen the female dwarves, but we weren't paying attention.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, I guess my... I mean, the reason I'm talking about secondary sexual characteristics is that, I mean, obviously, among humans, it's just a major difference, right? I mean, female facial hair just is, you know, never is the same.
It exists in biology. I mean, it's a thing.
Right, exactly. But of course, like, hair on the head in general is not a secondary sexual characteristic, right? I mean, like, of course, there are many differences and many individual differences and lots of differences in styling, right? And women don't tend to go bald as often. But I mean, in general, like, it's not like a secondary sexual characteristic to have hair on your head or not. And the hair of men and the hair of women, although, again, stylistic changes are made, it's not like intrinsically different generally, right? So if we wanted to go that same way with the dwarves, to say that dwarf beards are like human head hair in the sense of all dwarves have, you know, although there are individual variations and they may have stylistic choices, dwarf women may choose to do a particular thing with their beards that men don't. Again, just as, you know, how hair is worn among men and women, there are, you know, trends, stylistic trends in different cultures. So, you know, again, we can do that kind of thing. But I would be fine with that if that's where we want to go. I think my primary resistance to it is that it tends to be a joke that people make. It was a joke that was made in the films and a joke that many people enjoy as a joke about the bearded dwarf women. I would rather not do that. And I would certainly rather not have, I agree with you about the wispy beards and stuff. Like, we need to go all the way or not, I think. You know, like, either they all have beards or the women don't have beards. Mm-hmm. But the idea of having, like...
I just didn't think the wispy beards are very attractive.
It's not like, very attractive, but it's kind off. Of silly. Like, if they either... Like, if they grow beards, have them grow beards. If they don't grow beards, have them not grow beards. You know, this is not just, like... You know,
And they were in the background too. So I was like, "Who cares if you commit? No one's going to notice except weirdos like us."
Right, and even from a whole gender perspective, right? The idea of having women be half-hearted men, you know, like, come on, like, seriously? No, that's you know, you can tell
that's
that,
actually.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
That leads into something that I was thinking about dwarf costuming. Which was, there is evidence in the text that there isn't a significant demarcation in terms of gender roles.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't remember where the reference comes from, but there is specifically a place in the text where Tolkien explains why dwarf population increases slowly.
Yes.
And that is because there are very few dwarf women, and the dwarf women that there are more interested in doing their projects than they are interested in having families.
Yes.
Which to me indicates that it's very acceptable in dwarf culture for women to do very similar things to men. And so in that sense, there wouldn't need to be a significant difference between male and female clothing.
Yes.
The difference would primarily be what your job is.
Right?
So maybe if a dwarf woman was raising a family, she would have more sort of family-oriented clothing, but if the dwarf woman is at the forge making cool stuff, then she would be wearing appropriate to forge clothing.
She would be dressed like a smith, right?
Exactly. Yeah, which might be why it's so hard to tell the difference, is because their demarcations are based on their jobs rather than their gender.
Right.
The other thing with the beards, I think it's been treated as a joke because we were never, no one thought we would ever get it. So it's just like, hey.
Right.
I mean, we make jokes all the time about stuff that's never going to happen.
We can break through that. Yeah.
Because
we see beards on female, human, real women and not female people with dwarven proportions.
Right.
Which would require prosthetics and stuff. So I think if we design a face that's meant to have a beard but still be female and not just like tacked on to a human female, I think that will go a long way as well. Because they don't look like us. Not quite. I mean, that's the whole thing.
Right, exactly.
Ollie and stuff.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So no, that's, I think that's good. I think that makes sense. Okay. We should move along as we're going to completely run out of time to talk about any of the bad guys, which would be sad.
Just so that we know, I'm going to put information about the pictures that we put up there, because some of them are actual people, and I want to just make sure.
Okay, sure.
That people know.
Well, they're all actual people.
Well, but like, but we're giving credit.
Yeah,
where credit
cosplay
is due.
Groups and stuff. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So I'll put links up in the forum.
Great, great. Okay, cool. So here we have some of Hyrungil's sketches for the villains. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mainly the Aang Band gang.
Yeah, and yes. The comment that was made about Aang Band is that Hyrungil was thinking that Aang Band would be like the high point of the evil culture. Mm-hmm. So like they would have sort of all of the things that you would imagine that a very developed culture would have in Aang Band, and then it would sort of slowly deteriorate as the ages right. went on.
Right.
So that's, I think that's kind of what he's trying to show in this left-hand picture is, I think it was Morgoth with sort of his retinue, I guess. Right. Let me find that bit on the forums.
Right. Yeah, yeah, it's clearly kind of a concept sketch, right? Of how it would look. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So
I think the idea that was stated was that it's more like evil at its most organized point, where right. they built up all this stuff, and then it's going to be falling apart for the next couple of thousand years.
Yes.
So it needs to be high enough that yes. it falls apart at the end of the War of the Ring, and not sooner.
Right, and it's already a, you know, so we had, in a sense, of course, the pinnacle of evil, you know, organization and artistry was Utumno, right? So I would think, like, what was on display when Manwë comes to appeal, to make his final appeal to Melkor near the end of season one, would be the real pinnacle of things. But it's different then, right? We didn't have the whole evil crew, right? But anyway, so Aang Band has already, in a sense, fallen from that. We no longer have just pure gorgeousness. We have everything tainted by the hatred and rage, which is really dominating Morgoth now. But
Morgoth doesn't really fall apart until Aang Band. I mean,
right,
he
exactly.
has a potential to become as great as he was after his imprisonment, but then he doesn't. So it doesn't really start until after he gets his emeralds that it
right.
starts falling apart for him.
Right, right. Agreed. Okay, so we have, so with Morgoth, we have, these are, I know, so Bree, these are some of your drawings up there on the top left, right?
Yeah, I muted myself. I had this GIF where I had it transitioning between like
yeah.
his Melkor form to his Morgoth form. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to have the helm change to the helm he eventually has, so it's having it like fire. And Hyrungil did similar sketches of the helm below that.
Right, right.
But everyone's pretty much on board with the three spikes on a helm for each of
the
moral thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, I know that makes a lot of sense. How inhuman would
it also
we
looks
want...
like the three mountains of Aang Band. So.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. No, there's lots of benefits there. How inhuman would we want him to look as Morgoth? Like when he comes in the, especially in the like the post Ungoliant stage of things, right? After he's been rescued and he's been burned, you know, his hand has been burned. Would we want his humanity to be, and we want his humanity to kind of decrease over time, right?
Yeah, I have this really specific image that I've yet to be able to capture. I've tried drawing it a few times. One day I'll get it. Where he looks like he has normal coloring of a person who's alive. Once he gets his power isn't like seeping into the whole Morgoth ring concept yet. But after that point it is. So I thought that his power goes away, like sort of like draining, and to show that in a physical way, maybe he becomes paler as like one color fading
right.
slowly. And then it's just like his eyes become paler and he becomes more like a statue.
Right.
Sort of.
Right.
in that sense, and less of like a living person, because he becomes less and less and less and less, and that's really, it's show that it's like he's defeating himself.
Yes, yes.
More than anything else.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Tony suggests he should start out as hot goth and become more and more necrotic as time goes on. exactly. Necrotic, I think, is exactly it, right? He should look more and more, not like a rotting corpse exactly. I mean, we don't want like bits of him falling off, but more, as you say, more inhuman, more like a statue, less living, less.
And he's more armored too, and armor's not alive.
Yes.
I mean, Clav isn't either, but you see it moving more, so it's more animated, which is, you know, alive in a different sense. Right. So he's just becomes more sedentary, too.
Yes, so. And more, you know, conveying more like an empty shell, right, which I think is a really good image for Morgoth in the later, in the later era. Okay. So Gothmog and the orcs. Now, Gothmog, we want Gothmog to be, I mean, of course, the Balrog's not enormously distinct, so did we decide what we wanted the Balrogs to look like? We kind of needed to have decided this, right?
I think you guys mainly just said what you didn't want them to look like.
Well, yeah.
Mainly just, like, no wings.
Right.
Over and over again was what I usually remember you saying, and I always try to sneak in the fact that they still have wings, but they're just like smoke, so they're not really wings, it's just like a projection mentally.
Right, right.
But still looks cool, but they're not actually flyable.
Right.
He has dreams, Gothmog has.
Well, because they have, because they remember their wings, right? They used to have wings,
yeah.
And they still remember their wings, so like, their Fea are like still kind of winged, but their Hroa aren't anywhere. The Hroa in which they're encased, you know, the bodies
in
which they're
encased. It looks like the drawing on the left is fiery wings, maybe. I see like a little line there.
Right.
Which would make sense, like, if you have the fire.
That so one?
Like, if the fire went out, it'd probably just be like broken wings, maybe. Yeah. It looks like there are some.
Gothmog.
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah.
So the comments that Erendil has
about them being brown. Yes.
Yeah.
Is that he does wear armor, and it's very fine scale. He wears clothes made of some fabric that has sort of a flame pattern on it, and the three peaks of Thangorodrim. And he has burned skin and the remains of former wings is what that left-hand picture is evoking.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. I'm totally fine with, I'm willing to certainly make this compromise with, I know, and I've talked about this a lot. Like, I totally understand why visual artists always want Balrogs to have
wings.
We've
been talking about it for like 10 years.
It looks cool, right? I mean, I totally get that. And I love the way, I kind of really like the way in which the story that we developed for the Balrogs, you know, the whole fallen angels thing about Balrogs, does allow for that, right? Like, again, they remember their wings, like they've lost them and they can't get them back, but they remember them, right? And so we can have either flaming or shadowy wings, again, as like with the memory of their. Of their flying and stuff. Face scarred, hideous, still attractive. What do we think about the face of the faces of, and human still looking like, I mean, you know, not like with muzzles and horns and things like that, I'm presuming, right? Still,
it looks like he has his drawing that it's burned.
Burned.
Yeah,
yes.
He says that I think. It's burned.
Which would make sense if they're, like, sort of burning themselves.
Right.
In terms of self-destruction theme.
Yeah, the idea of, like, flame emerging from them, but as if the flame is itself damaging them at the same time, I think would be evocative of the kind of spiritual state of the Balrog that we're attempting to describe. You know, less like someone who is merely, like, a composed of flame and shadow, like that has been made from scratch from flame and shadow, like a fire elemental or something like that, and more like someone who has been burned, right? Which they have. It was their own fault, right? And it's their own choice.
I think there's two possible looks maybe more than two. But I think maybe what everyone's thinking about is skin that's healed, but maybe you know how like horrible skeletons look when they get burned, they're just like black.
Mm-hmm.
And there's the skin has shrunk all the way around the skeleton. It's right. still there, but it's not right. really there.
Right.
Maybe like something like that, and then you can make a cool skull shape that's black, and yeah. it's like the fires kind of blend. Maybe something like that. I'm coming up with this right now. But, no, I mean, yeah.
The idea of the Balrogs having almost naked skulls, as you say, like blackened leathery skin. So right, not like a person with a normal face with burned skin, but rather, you
yeah, because that implies healing.
Right. Burned down. You know. Exactly. It implies healing. Burned yeah. down almost to the bone so that they have almost a death's head skull look. That would be scary. I kind of like that, actually.
Balrogs are scary.
Balrogs are scary. They should be scary. And I mean, if they look like a death's head, well, like that's good, right? That's kind of, that is a look we would go for.
But not too much like that one. I think it's a Marvel character. What's his name?
Are you thinking of the?
Yeah, I can't think of
dude on the motorcycle with the motorcycle. Yes,
not so not so metal is that.
Not so metal is that. Yes, exactly. Yeah, Ghost Rider. Thank you, Zach. Yes, Ghost Rider.
Ghost Rider. That's what. Yes. I kept seeing Skull Rider. I'm like, that's not right.
That's right. Okay. Right concept, wrong name. Yes, Ghost Rider. Yeah, it shouldn't look like Ghost Rider. I agree. But especially since Ghost Rider was more naked skull, you should still be able to see the skin. Like it should like a skull yeah. with like black wax melted on it, almost. You know, would be
like
more
not Legend of Zelda skull laughing in a little flame ball.
Right, exactly. Not like that. Yes. Yeah. Good. Okay. So I was going to say we're running out of time. I'm actually significantly over time now, and I should go pretty soon.
Make the call if you need to make the call.
I do need to make the call. And my call is between rushing through the rest of the bad guys super fast or saving some for next time. Could you guys come a little bit at the beginning of next time?
When is next time?
2 weeks from today.
Maybe. I might only be able to do chat, but I might be able to do it. Okay. Depends All right. on work.
That's fine. That's fine. We can talk about some stuff.
Almost half the slides, which is about right.
We've only got like two left of the design slides.
Well, I meant total, but we were total never going to do the other ones.
Yeah, no, that was not going to happen. Yeah, because we have the orcs still to talk about, and then like Thorin Gwethil, right? I mean, you know, come on, we still got Thorin Gwethil.
Oh yeah.
Not to mention, I think we have Tevildo stuff. Oh, Dragluin and Tevildo. So we have
the Angband gang. And
we got to finish it. We can't. And orcs, like we can't. We got to talk about orcs in more than 30 seconds. So, all right. Well, so we'll finish up the Angband gang at the beginning of next time, and then we're doing casting. So that's fine. We can totally make that work. That'll absolutely happen. So let me wrap up then, and thank you guys so much, not only for your work, but for your time today. This was super helpful. I learned so much, not only that smocking is a verb, and a verbal noun, right? I mean, this is fantastic. I learned a very great deal from you guys today, and this is really neat. I love thinking about this stuff in this way. You know, clothing and costume design is normally not one of the things that I am especially independently interested in, but it's really great to talk about it with folks who know about it so that we can focus, you know, so enabling me to ask questions and focus on the sort of the world building and character development and story elements of this stuff, because that's really cool. And there's a lot to talk about there.
It's all just storytelling, just in different modes.
Exactly. Exactly. And you guys were super helpful with that. So thank you guys so much.
You're welcome.
Awesome. Okay, so we will sign off. I'm going to head over to my Grifflet stream here in just a minute. Thanks again for joining us, and we will be back in 2 weeks. That is, which date is that going to be? That's going to be the 13th. Yes, Friday the 13th of July will be our next session where we will finish up the visual design stuff, and then it will finish talking about the bad guys, and then we will do casting, which means our nominations for casting are closing. We're going to have the voting link. So we're going to be electing our folks, our actors and actresses between now and next time. So be on the lookout in the forums for the link to the survey, so that you can vote on who should be portraying whom. And of course, we have links to the to all the nominations in the forum and stuff. So you'll want to look at that, and then we'll be announcing the winners next time, which is always a fun time. And then I get in trouble if I don't veto the correct ones and everything. So that's always fun. Anyway, thank you guys. Thanks everybody for joining us. Thank you guys for your help. And I will say, as always,
thanks for having us.
No problem. Thank you. Yeah. That was great. And I will say, as always, thanks for listening, and Godspeed.